Welcome to Watching Westworld, the officially unofficial podcast for Westworld on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 3, titled The Stray. We got a runaway bot. We got a runaway host. What do you do about that?
I don't know. It seems like we have multiple runaway hosts. I mean, Dolores, I think you'd be just as apt to describe her as The Stray. And it's kind of keeping in the tricksy meanings because, you know, when I first saw the pilot, the original, you think it's going to be something about the original Westworld, and it turns out it's about Dolores. And then Chestnut, we talked about how I had multiple meanings last week, and we got a new one in the feedback. And then this is The Stray. We have the obvious Stray in the canyon, but then the unobvious secret Stray, Dolores.
Mm-hmm. Straying from her loop.
Straying from her loop. She's not keeping her promise to Bernard, which makes you think, what other promises she's not keeping? Vis-a-vis not telling people about conversations she's having. I don't know. I like this episode because I think it's the first one that started giving us clues to the human motivations.
Yeah.
Like, we really started getting some clues, not complete clues, because it wouldn't be Westworld if it was just straightforward and obvious, but a lot of clues about Ford's background and what he's doing and maybe what he's not doing. A lot more clues about Bernard's history and what he's doing.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about those two in depth because they're the driving force behind all of this, or so it seems.
It's a triad of them and Ed Harris seems to be the primary. If you're talking about human and asterisks there by the man in black, actually asterisks by all three of them, because there's a pretty vigorous debate and case to be made that they're all hosts. They're no guest here.
I don't buy that in any way. But,
sure.
All right.
But I think with Bernard and Dr. Ford that maybe you're supposed to wonder, you know, if they're human. But
when you see the scene of Ford giving Teddy his backstory,
right?
How can you watch that scene and not go, well, maybe all of these people are. Well,
especially when you got that jackass, you know, what are they called? The reaction force, the security force, when he's, you know, joking with the girl, oh, maybe stellar cartography is part of my backstory. I mean,
right.
A lot of that is us having them having a laugh at us, the audience, or with us, the audience. But a lot of it also intentionally blurs the line between what they tell us are obviously hosts and guests and
the very premise itself of the show.
Right. Are these robots or are they people?
Right. And by extension, are we people or are we robots?
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
There's effectively no difference at some point. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, no one denies that we are biologically meat, right?
Right.
But yes, we grant that because we have this thing called consciousness that makes us different from the animals we exploit and any other thing, living thing on Earth. So, yeah. Great show. It seems to be a great show.
It is. I still have like 15 windows open in my browser of just like stuff I was reading right up till the point where we had to do this podcast. So.
I got 15 windows open in my brain trying to keep all this stuff straight.
Yep.
Plus,
I'm bicameral.
Are you keeping up with the state of the art as far as the ARG game?
I have not, no.
Because
it was a very, very busy weekend for us. So
sure.
I've not had a chance.
They've added to the Visit Westworld site a little AI bot that like you can chat with and ask questions about your visit and the nature of the park, and you can get it to crash and say some really interesting debugging stuff that we'll be talking about in the feedback section. They continue to be amping up. Ramping up each week, there's probably going to be some new delight or horror, as it were, on their website. So,
right,
passionate fans probably want to. I've got mixed feelings about this multiple channels of information they're being employed here, but it's pretty cool so far.
Yep. Do we have anything we want to do before we get to the recap?
I don't think so.
Should we just go for it?
Let's do it.
Okay, we start off with Dolores once again being questioned by Bernard. He gives her a copy of Alice in Wonderland. Has her read a few passages from it, and then kind of asks her if they mean anything to her. And there's, you know, a little bit more discussion here, but that's the main thrust of this scene. I don't have all of the passages she reads, but one of them was essentially about if she's been changed in the night.
Mm-hmm.
How queer everything feels today, I think, is the first part of that.
Right.
I
just feel like if... you're trying to, I don't know, I thought, I made the joke when I was watching it about Jeffrey Wright's character Bernard. Like, if you, it seems almost reckless to give a robot that you have got, you know, to feed them this kind of material, Alice in Wonderland. If you're trying to awaken a consciousness or whatever, like, Jesus Christ, why don't you sit her down and watch, let her watch The Terminator?
Right.
Introduce her to the concept of Skynet. You know, it's like, this is dangerous reading for a threshold AI character. But
yep, and I think Bernard is aware of that.
I think, yeah, he seems... I mean, I think it's fascinating their second conversation after he has the conversation with Dr. Ford where he's got some misgivings, but he leaves it almost more convinced than ever about the righteousness of what he's doing.
Right, and it seems that he's convinced by Dolores herself in that moment. So, like, this first conversation, it's very clear that, you know, he's acting as kind of a rogue element here, and, certainly without Ford's implicit permission,
right.
But, explicit permission, but there does seem to be some kind of implicit permission here to do what Bernard is doing.
You think so? Why?
Just the conversation they had about mistakes in the first episode, and kind of how Ford himself put the reveries in. I think there's some kind of collusion, like not direct collusion here, but they both understand what each of them are doing and they're allowing it to happen.
I think you might be onto something with Ford, but on the other hand, he did directly caution him from doing this thing. Like, don't make the mistake of, now this could be, you know, a question that is, you know, if you know Bernard and his smart, inquisitive nature and the fact that he's searching for answers as far as immortality and, you know, how to retain memories of the deceased and you know, moving towards away from the artificial and towards the real, then I guess if you're a smart character like Dr. Ford, you could say something like that just to send him down that path.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's essentially... you know, every time you see in a horror movie, hey, don't ever go into the east wing of the mansion.
Right.
Don't ever try. It's like, you know for sure that in the fucking second act, the character's going to go into the east wing because you just told him not to.
Yeah.
They might not even known about the east wing, but now for damn sure, it's like, you know, piqued their interest. Yes, exactly.
Accepted him. And then also, I feel like Ford's motivations are kind of linked to this concept of bicameral mind, which I want to talk about more later when we get to it. But he does seem to have some kind of duality to him,
right?
Both in the decisions he makes and kind of how he treats these bots. So,
I also want to point out what I thought was interesting is he keeps asking if she's told any one of her conversations.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't respond in the affirmative or negative. She just repeats, "You told me not to." That's not a denial, and I think that's
true. Yeah,
that's interesting when you have her like to keep in mind for further interactions and as the season develops, because I don't think that even Bernard's aware to the extent that she perhaps is playing him.
Yeah.
So
I can agree with that,
because he was alarmed by the fact that she went right to his son, asked questions about her son or his son, and she disarmed him by, you know, first of all, he's still believing that when he tells her into analysis mode that's actually,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. There's just so many subtle things I see this actress doing when she, like when Dolores comes back online, she like does this subtle kind of like pleasant smile routine, and then she loses that and she goes to analysis mode. That's what the robot's doing. That could easily be an affect.
Sure.
You know, that they're going along with these things. I don't know. I feel like increasingly we're going to see her conversations with Bernard. We are going to understand that she's manipulating him, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, I think at the end of that, when she says she doesn't know why she said a particular thing,
right?
That kind of indicates to me that this analysis mode is still working.
Yeah, or
because if she were hiding it the entire time, she would have just made up some other excuse for that.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, maybe articulating that I think they're laying the groundwork for some of these responses that she's too primitive in her state of conscious development to understand the utility of lying, but.
Right.
They're kind of, I'm aware as an audience, they're lulling us into this belief that this is like some kind of superpower that she right. that must be, yeah. but she's already giving answers and he's accepting them. And I'm not saying that she's being deceptive when she says you told me not to. However, we as the audience and Bernard accept that as like essentially confirming that she didn't when in fact she did not. So
right.
it's like I don't think she's lying right now, but she could, mm-hmm. and nobody is really picking up on that.
Maybe she could. I don't know. I'm not sure how these work because he does say that kind of this analysis function,
right.
these voice commands are kind of the only thing left of Arnold's work, his sort of quest for consciousness.
But it just seems like that's not literally true because we are seeing her develop a form of consciousness before our eyes.
Right.
So if they'd stripped all that stuff out, except for maybe the ability for them to interpret, you know, the conversations they're having as dreams and the voices they're hearing as kind of like, you know, imperatives from some godhood.
Well, I mean, I think those were put back in with the reveries, right?
Mm.
I mean, that's Ford's contribution to this whole
mess. So you're saying that he's surreptitiously inserting this old Arnold code back into their routines?
Seems like it. Huh. Yeah, I get the impression very much that as Dr. Ford is aging and as he sees what his work has become,
he's viewing his partner's work in a different light.
Right. He now doesn't view him as an obsessed madman.
Uh-huh.
Who is kind of off the rails as far as the mission, which is to please people with a old-timey park.
Right.
He now kind of sees him as doing something bigger and grander right. and maybe wants to follow in the footsteps. I don't know.
Interesting. I got a lot more.
It is weird what he tells Bernard.
When we get to the office scene, I want to really dive into that because there's some intriguing, I think, half-truths being told here.
Okay.
But we'll see.
Alice in Wonderland, this book.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Dolores kind of looks like Alice.
Yeah. It's obvious in retrospect, the blonde girl with the kind of right. curls in her hair and the light blue dress yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they're obviously leaning into that. I read an interview with a couple of the writers, and one of them, one of the things that they're taking inspiration from, obviously, is Alice in Wonderland. The other thing, there's a painting called Christina's World, which, if you look at it, is very much like the ranch that Dolores lives on.
Right.
And that painting shows kind of a girl looking up, like laying in the grass, looking up these plains toward a house on a hilltop.
Hmm.
And it's not necessarily unsettling, and it doesn't necessarily imply that there's anything bad going on up there,
mm-hmm.
but there's some kind of either longing in just the girl's positioning
mm-hmm.
or some kind of fear that I was picking up on anyway in the painting, but I'm not sure exactly what they're getting at with that. But yeah, Christina's World, I don't know who the artist is. So Dolores is sent back to the park where she wakes up and finds a gun in her dresser. And then she has a flashback of the man in black from the barn. And when she comes out of it, the gun has vanished and she goes on with her day.
So there's a theory that we're going to be talking about throughout this that I don't personally find persuasive, but we're going to have to talk about it. The fact that we're having different timelines. That essentially the man in black and William are a 30-year different timeline, and that we perhaps are seeing the genesis of the man in black and William, or that fact that the William storyline takes place 30 years ago in Dolores' timeline as well, and that these are formative events and some part, you know, portions. Like, there's one theory that William literally becomes the man in black. There's another theory that, you know, whatever William's actions do are what started Dolores down this path,
mm-hmm.
and this is one of the points, one of the pieces of evidence towards that theory, the fact that, you know, she had the gun and now she doesn't have the gun. Like, one of these is the different timeline. I interpreted it as her programming kicking in. There's something that's anomalous that's not supposed to be here, like a picture of a woman standing in Times Square,
uh-huh.
and her consciousness is stripping it out.
Right.
So she looks and the gun's gone after she has this flashback. What do you buy that interpretation? Or?
Yeah, I mean, that seems to track with what she said when her father showed her the picture.
Doesn't
she
look
said,
like anything at all.
Looks like nothing. Yeah.
Right. So you see a gun and like, I'm not supposed to have this gun, so the gun shouldn't exist.
Right. Then she goes about her day. I don't know. It definitely it comes up again. Certainly this idea of the gun. We'll get to that. William's walking through town where he watches a guy being brought out, brought in on a bounty. And the guy shoots some people and tries to escape by taking a hostage. And he shoots William in the shoulder and he's knocked down, but he gets back up and he kills the guy. And this bounty hunter invites William on a mission and he decides to go on a bounty of his own. Bounty hunt of his own. Logan is just constantly fucking. There is not a moment that he's in this park that he's not fucking something.
Right. If his balls aren't aching, then it's time to fuck again.
Yeah.
They do nail down kind of the particulars of their relationship. They may or may not also work together, but we know for sure that they're either. I think they're future brother-in-laws. That William is in a relationship. He's engaged to his sister. I'm actually reading this as some kind of extended brother-in-law bachelor party.
Right.
And that William maybe doesn't like her brother. And maybe, he's Logan's not aware of how much he doesn't like him. Mm-hmm. That sometimes happens.
Sure.
But he's stuck with him because, go with my brother. It'll be fun. I don't know. It's interesting. Because also Logan implies that, his sister, William's fiancée/girlfriend/perhaps newlywed wife, has come to this park and fucked a shit ton of cowboys.
Okay.
Now, maybe that's Logan projecting.
Might be, yeah.
Because he didn't say I had certain knowledge. He says, what, you think my sister didn't ride, blah, 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 last episode. So, I don't know. That stuff is interesting, I guess. I just loathe Logan's character.
Okay. Anything to this bounty hunt? I mean, it seems like that's just there to get William out in the desert.
Yeah, to stumble across Dolores, who might have had this breakdown 30 years in the past, or if you believe what I believe, and this is a unified timeline, mm-hmm. He's there when she goes off her loop.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
Right. Okay. Teresa confronts Bernard about the increasing problem that is Dr. Ford's secret storyline and tells him that the board wants them to get their shit together, basically. They can't have a bunch of bots running around, like half the storylines are in disarray because of this thing. Like
he's carving out large swaths of the park for this storyline, which I think is interesting. Mm-hmm. What does that look like?
How much is that?
Is there like yellow lines and like Ford's narrative do not cross? Like what does that mean?
I suppose you could just put a couple lines of code in the bots to just say, don't go out this way.
Yeah, but if I was a guest, I would be like, fuck yeah, I'm going out that way. It's the whole don't go in East Wing problem.
Oh, sure. I mean, the guests could go, but they don't know not to go there.
I guess
there.
That's and true. If it seems like this place is so huge that mm-hmm. unless you just start wandering off in one direction, you're probably not going to – you're going to go wherever the storylines are taking you or whether the hosts are talking about.
Yeah. And if the host suggests, hey, we should go up to this mountain and find the bad guy versus the other mountain.
Like, right.
They could probably lead you by the nose.
Sure.
And also
the fact that Bernard is getting into some trouble here because some of his technicians, i.e. What's the kind of mousy looking one that's got the foul mouth that's always saying?
Elsie.
Yeah. Elsie's getting him in some hot water because he's saying this is all case closed and she is still pulling at the edges of this.
Yeah,
she told her not to do last episode.
Well, she's a curious person. That's why she's good at her job.
Seems like nobody does anything that they're supposed to do in this park. It's a wonder it's not just a house of cards. Maybe it is a house of cards.
Yeah, so she's analyzing what happened with the milk bottle bandits. And she comes to the conclusion that Walter was holding a grudge. Fortunately for Bernard, she notices there's a stray host. And Bernard tells her, you should go check that. You should go grab this host while I finish up the procedure here.
Sure.
I'll do a little digging. And you can see it on her face that she's both surprised to be taken off in the middle of what she considers an important discovery
mm-hmm.
and also unsure of the intentions of Bernard.
Yeah. Or whether she's being punished. Is this like a punishment detail? What's going on?
Yeah. She's going to start wising up pretty soon. I think the biggest foil for Bernard is going to be her.
Hmm.
Because she's the closest to the problem. She seems very smart. She is curious.
It definitely seems like they have a very similar tension. Like, Bernard is to Ford as Elsie is to Bernard.
Okay.
Possibly, except for Ford might be leading him a little bit more.
Right.
But, because
I think he is.
Because Bernard's poking at the edges of Ford's plan, which mm-hmm. I don't know that Ford necessarily appreciates. Okay. And Elsie's poking at the fringes of, she is not even aware of it, but she's poking uncomfortably close to the fringes of Bernard's larger plan with Dolores, and he doesn't like that.
Yeah. All right.
I thought it was also interesting, you know, when we later found out about Arnold, that this Walter, who's the growing boy, milk pourer, he is referencing him by name.
Yeah.
Not a character, not a host, not a guest, the actual co-founder of the park.
Right.
What the hell? What?
That is certainly interesting. He says, I need more milk, Arnold. Who's Arnold? And why
we find out later, and that doesn't really help us make more sense of the situation.
Right.
I don't think so, anyway.
And, you know, we find out that all six of these victims were people who participated in his killing in previous narratives, which is why Elsie is suspicious of it. That's kind of the clue that she uncovers.
Yeah.
And then Elsie and Stubbs ride up an elevator to go after the stray. Stubbs says he doesn't trust the code and that he keeps a gun with him because of that, you know, just a single line of code keeping it. I doubt it's one line.
No,
I seriously doubt it's one line. This guy doesn't understand code.
Well,
but
it's also not even like, as we explored last week, it's not even necessarily code. It's this heuristic network of imperatives and information and backstory and hobbies. And like, I'm with him, man. I would never go in that park without something that could take down a robot.
Me too.
So, and he, I think he's validated in this belief by the time the episode comes to a close.
I would say so. So Teddy and a woman shoot a guy in the street for a bounty, and they head over to the saloon where Maeve has a flashback to her time in the lab where she saw Teddy dead on the floor. And the woman who's with Teddy goes upstairs with Clementine, and Teddy sees Dolores outside. Their loop kind of starts again with the milk, and they head out into the field where Dolores tries to convince Teddy to run away with her, which I think is different. I don't think this has happened before.
No, and it's something, you know, it's interesting because, as Ford explains here in a minute, Teddy's real purpose is to keep Dolores on the farm.
Right.
Which he is actually doing, and I think it's interesting that I guess this kind of goes into your theory that Ford is doing this stuff with Bernard deliberately, because it's awful convenient for Bernard's experiment Dolores that Ford is taking Teddy off of his primary task,
right,
of keeping her on the farm at the exact same point that she's establishing this consciousness and this yearning to find out if there's anything more to the larger world outside.
Yeah.
Also, this loop just keeps getting sadder and sadder. Like, every iteration of these robots who are kind of sort of falling in love, one of them genuinely and the other going through the motions.
Right.
It's tragic in every sense of the word. I feel so badly for them both.
Okay. I really don't still.
Wow.
I'm starting to get there.
But, okay.
Just from the one side. Like, Teddy has no fucking clue what's going on.
Well, no, but I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's just as pathetic to be
metal.
It's just as pathetic to fall. I mean, this is all stuff that was explored in the movie Her, but it's somewhat pathetic to be in this unrequited love affair with a piece of hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, I guess the twist in Her is that then it isn't unrequited, and then it gets more and more
right.
complicated. So,
it's just so impossible.
Yeah, but here it's funny that a robot is falling in love with a less sophisticated, evolved robot.
Mm.
It seems very a human thing to do.
Yeah, and there's this concept of someday that Dolores latches onto and doesn't enjoy.
She's starting to feel the control, the edges of the fence that she's in, right?
Yeah, I mean, to me, so it's interesting. Like, I know Teddy is there to keep her on the ranch, but I think it's more the concept of Teddy than the actual physical presence of Teddy. Because Teddy, we've seen him go off on missions. We've seen him not be with Dolores for a day, right?
Right.
So I think it's the original idea that Teddy's coming back for me.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
He always, like, that's what he starts with. I told you I'd come back for you someday.
Yeah, and that's how he always leaves, I noticed. That you know, when he goes off on this quest, he says, I'll be back.
So Teddy as a concept is there to keep Dolores.
Even when
on
he's
the
not like physically, I don't think he's like the Terminator. He'd show up like, where are you going, Dolores?
Right.
It's more like that's part of her control structure. That's what roots her into this place.
Yep. So they ride back to the farm where the bandits are doing their thing. And then we go to Ford, who has Teddy in the lab. He tells him that his backstory is too vague, and he uploads a new one about a man named Wyatt who went missing during a military mission and came back with, quote-unquote, some pretty strange ideas.
And he claims he can hear the voice of God, which is interesting in context with his bicameral mind concept. Mm-hmm. Also, what Ford says that this is like all the best fiction is rooted in truth. Mm-hmm. What the fuck? I guess that's is Wyatt essentially an evolved droid, an evolved synthetic robot, synthetic human.
Evolved synthetic human. Well, Wyatt doesn't exist, right? Wyatt is a figment of Teddy's imagination.
No, I think that there actually probably is going to be a robot that's identified as Wyatt. We meet Wyatt's men, so okay. I don't understand why. But the fact that what makes him different is he's a delusional, insane. I mean he's exactly what Dr. Ford and Bernard are going to be talking about here in a bit.
Yeah, I mean when I think about it through the lens of that bicameralism, mm-hmm. I don't know that I would call him insane. I would call him conscious.
I'm just saying, using Dr. Ford's own terminology, he says there's two, you know, he says there's two types of people that talk to themselves, and he didn't really elaborate on the first type, but he goes, the second type are those that are, Bernard's themselves are insane. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just think it's interesting. You know, we talked about introducing religion, into the park as one of Dr. Ford's mission objectives. That's a theory from last week. Then he's talking about this character that can hear the voice of God. We know that that's how one experimental way of getting the robots to be conscious went with his former partner. This stuff is just, I don't know where it's all going, but it's definitely going in that direction.
What do you make of the opening statement in this scene that is a quote from, I think, Shakespeare? Says a coward dies 1,000 deaths.
The hero but one. Or the whatever.
Essentially, the valiant taste of death but once or something. What is he getting at? I mean, other than the obvious, which is Teddy doesn't die and Teddy doesn't feel these things.
Right.
And the irony that is he has actually died like 1,000 times.
Yet it hasn't dulled his courage.
Right. It feels like there should be something more to that than just some sense of irony.
It does. Yeah, I mean, you could take it as just Dr. Ford just essentially intellectually masturbating in front of this inanimate object.
You could.
But, yeah, the show doesn't really encourage a shallow analysis of that, does it?
But I'm trying to dig into it deeper because I think that kind of thing would betray his goals in some way.
Well, I mean, it's also, I don't know, because also it does seem like maybe that this is something that Dr. Ford does intentionally to dehumanize his creations. It doesn't fit with like our theory that he's trying to humanize them, but like as he, you know, berates this technician later on, like, you know, why are you making any kind of concessions of this fiction, this fake thing's comfort? And like the fact that he is, the whole time he's talking shit to Teddy. He's like, oh, you think, he's like, well, you're never going to have her. And you exist only to be somebody, you know, to be the rung that someone steps up on their, you know, ladder of self-esteem. And,
right.
And
oh, you don't know who Wyatt is? It's because I haven't given you that knowledge.
Yeah,
yet.
It's like he almost, I don't know whether he enjoys taunting his creation, or maybe he's just always being this brutal to keep this lesson in front of his mind so he doesn't accidentally humanize them. But if that's the goal, it kind of it kind of flies in the face of what I think he's doing in a larger way.
Yeah, yeah. His actions seem to be betraying his ends, or I don't know. He's kind of being hypocritical here with what he's saying and what he's doing.
Right. Which I like to, you know, there's this saying that like if you want to know what a person's really doing, don't listen to them. Watch what they do.
Right.
So I feel like his actions are betraying someone who's trying to lead these robots to some form of consciousness, and it doesn't matter what he's saying. It could be he could be saying that just so it's like, you know, no one would suspect. Mm-hmm. Like, well, you know, Dr. Ford's he's the least evolved and most brutal in the way he treats these creation. I don't know. So it could be he's just using this as some sort of social camouflage.
Could be. Dolores is hassled by the milk bottle bandits in town, and they have a guest with them who backs down when Teddy challenges him, and the bandits leave. And
so it seems like a guy who might want to, like, hey, I want to be a bad guy, so put me on the bad guy track.
Right, but it's his first time
but
here.
But he's a noob, a bad guy.
He wants something easy.
He wants to dip his toes into blackout water.
Right. Teddy's too high level for him. The bandits leave. Teddy takes Dolores out to the desert to learn how to shoot, but she's unable to fire the weapon. And then the sheriff rides up and tells Teddy, hey, we found Wyatt. He says goodbye to Dolores and leaves with the sheriff.
Right.
We got to talk about this gun.
Yeah, the fact that I think that they're getting at, much like the new code or the new restrictions put in place specify what characters can and cannot have a weapon.
Right.
That she just programmatically cannot wield this weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the other guys can't chop the wood because they're programmed.
It's not that she's unwilling to pull that trigger.
It's that she's physically unable. She has a restriction, just like, you know, I think it was also, now I'm starting to understand the rules of the park,
mm-hmm.
why Teddy could pump the man in black full of holes, but he couldn't, when the gun was right against his head, pull the trigger, because that actually might kill Ed Harris if he is indeed flesh and blood. If this simulated round, like, just like I wouldn't mean
right.
You can shoot me at 30 paces with a paintball gun and it's all fun and games. If you held it right to my eyeball, I'd be like, don't pull the trigger, man.
Yep.
So I think that this is, you know, she's just got, like, you know, guys like Teddy can wield these weapons, but they still are on some level of their consciousness aware of what will and will not kill a guest.
Right. It's very much
but
that.
But Dolores just can't.
Yeah.
She's classified as completely harmless.
Yeah, we've talked about this, how the bots are there to provide the illusion of danger, and they must... They're also there, like, they understand what their role is in this park.
Right.
But they can't use that information to influence their actions within the park, other
right.
than
they can't
to
metagame.
Keep the people safe. Right. Right. They're not. It almost seems like they're subconsciously aware of what their role is.
Well, that's kind of like a bicameral mind concept that
yeah,
they've
absolutely.
Got, like, they have awareness of the fact they're an android, or else this analysis and stuff wouldn't work. But they have, on a lower yeah. level, a show consciousness, or a stage consciousness that has the character details and all these scripted lines and whatnot. But that clearly can be dismissed or activated at will. So Teddy is aware that he's a robot, that he has non-lethal ammunition that could be lethal in the right circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that Dolores has that same programming, except for she's able to override it or overcome it.
Right, at the very end. We should describe what this bicameral mind is, because I don't think we've done that yet, and we've used the term
okay.
several times.
So this is a concept that was originated in the 1970s by a psychologist, Julian Jaynes, in the book The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, where he states that this human beings evolved, you know, mental, the brain and their consciousness, but, and you know, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. But he states up until about 3,000 years ago that the way we interpreted this phenomenon as our consciousness was that when we'd hear, like, our inner monologues, we would interpret as, like, you know, authoritative statements from a god figure. And
right.
he cites as evidence, there's a couple of things. He has physical evidence where he's like, you know, we have left and right brains.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like our speech centers are located in one side of the brain primarily. But we also have speech centers that are largely inactive in the other half of our mind.
Mm-hmm.
But when you hook up someone to an EKG and they're having a hallucination,
right.
Either induced by drugs or by psychosis, that dormant side of the language center is asserting itself and actually the active part.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why when you're hallucinating voices in your head, it feels so real, because your brain is interpreting that other half of the brain that's usually not processing language as an outside force.
You feel as if it's not coming from you.
And then so that's part of his analysis. The other part of the analysis, he goes back in historical literature and notes, like, if you look at really ancient texts, like the old Hebrew parts of the Bible, pre-classical Greek literature, stuff that was written down in scrolls of Egypt, there tends to be, like, they viewed consciousness, but they didn't have, like, the idea of you had a conscious and subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff that, like, that thoughts that were in your head that were not, like, I don't know. It's very hard for me to explain, because I don't quite understand it. But, like, when you see a novel, like, experience, like, when you go to the edge of the cliff and you're having a conversation, like, self, you better not get any closer than that.
Mm-hmm.
That ancient people actually interpreted that as a god telling them, like, giving them wisdom or something, you know, like,
right.
guidance on things that they weren't sure about.
And it's oftentimes it's just a figure of authority. So if it was associated with, like, a king, or associated with the leader of a tribe or something, like, they would hear that voice, essentially. Right. They would interpret it as being from that person. And right. so, like, it's reflected in a lot of death rituals as well, right. where and they preserve the body.
And why they would, you know, they wanted to keep this continuity. Like, the Egyptian kings became the literal gods because their right. decrees and commandments would still be in effect even after they're dead.
Yeah, people are still hearing those voices.
Now, interestingly enough, because there was an article that directly addressed this from a current psychologist and someone that studies the brain, a neurologist. Someone asked him this in context of he's actually works at the association that's named after Julian Jaynes. Mm-hmm. And they asked him, is like, has this been disproven? Because the show itself asserts that this is a disproven model of consciousness. He goes, it's not been disproven so much as it's been ignored. Like, right. you know, and think about it. How do you falsify this? How do you set up an experiment? It's a theory that has no way. I mean, there's no new information. There's nothing to prove it or disprove it. And
it's a very internal thing, too.
Yes.
Very difficult to examine in the first place.
Right.
Now, that's not to say that whatever future this show takes place in, right. like Camera Roll Mine, hasn't been completely debunked.
Right.
And proven false. But in our current world, right. it is not.
And it's also interesting because the way people talk about the bicameral mind is like, because it's not a change in our evolutionary, nothing changed in the mechanics of the brain. It's right. it's when they talk about it, they had an analogy as if it is a software update. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the way that we perceive and the way that we, as we move around from authoritative, you know, kings and high priests, and we move more towards a democracy and more to the idea that everyone has a say, mm-hmm. that way of looking at it changed the way we perceive our own identity and our thoughts.
Right, which, and it largely came about through the understanding and the more and more complex language that we use.
Yes.
Which ties right back into the show where they're talking about the bots talking with each other and how this may have emerged simply from them trying to be more human through language
right.
and discussing things with each other. They develop some sort of introspective abilities.
Right. And all this stuff is intentional, obviously. Like, it seems to me that Jonathan Nolan or his writers were familiar with this, and, like, you know, these things were yeah. all stewing, and it's like, oh, you know, even if it is a busted model of consciousness, like Dr. Ford asserts, there's nothing saying you couldn't develop this as a way to get consciousness, because there's probably multiple ways to get to consciousness.
Could be.
Obviously, yeah. evolution did not choose. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, these mistakes and accidents and mutations until we got to the way we got. So,
yeah. All right, so that's bicameral mind. So yep. you kind of have a better understanding of what we mean when we're talking about it. But yeah, I don't know if you want to talk any more about this gun, but Dolores is definitely surprised she can't pull the trigger.
Right.
Which comes into play.
And they rationalize, because I think that's in the real world, there's people that can pull a trigger and there can't. So then Teddy's right there to rationalize it. Like, you know, some people just weren't meant to.
Right. You know. The look on her face doesn't say, I can't do it because I don't want to.
Right.
Says, I can't do it because I physically can't pull this thing.
And that's the fascinating thing about the show is that they're, like, I feel like the robotic actors are doing some really heavy lifting mm-hmm. in doing a lot of this subtle things that can be interpreted multiple ways.
Oh, yeah. So several dudes are arguing about who's going to go chop firewood for their food around an unlit fire here. An unlit campfire.
I think it's hilarious that they might have been doing this for days, just arguing back yeah. and forth about who's the lazy fucker that won't.
Well, likely why can't have been.
You can chop the wood. Yeah. You don't have to have wood. Yeah, I think that's pretty funny.
Yeah, because the scene freezes and Elsie walks in explaining that the stray was the guy who was supposed to chop the wood for these fools. He left and he got these guys caught in a loop and they missed their other missions in town for a couple days now.
Right.
They go inside the tent and they find some carvings with strange symbols on them.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where, you know, they really solidify this idea of some bots just being programmed not to be able to use weapons, because Elsie says some of them can't even touch the axe.
Right.
And you know, she has a little conversation with Stubbs about weapons and like, oh, yeah, it's orders from Q&A, and you guys are so paranoid.
Right.
Q&A. QA. Sorry. We just did a Q&A. I'm confused.
Right, it's on your mind.
So I guess we'll talk a little more about the stars when we get there, yeah?
Yeah.
When we discover that they're stars.
Right. And so, I don't really even have them, you know, I don't know where that's going. Although, right. It does seem like the it looks like he's carving a turtle shell, and it had Orion. And I know when mm-hmm. we were watching, there's a debate about whether the bear had a carving of Ursa Major on it, which is the Big Dipper. Also, Ursa Major literally means big bear, because in the old horoscope that constellation was a bear, mm-hmm. not obviously a dipper.
Okay, and I don't know anything about the constellations other than their rough shapes. I don't know what they mean.
And also,
know.
like I didn't recognize Orion until she spun it in the right direction. And it's not completed. Also, like it didn't seem like he had like the head, shoulders, the waist, and the bow, but like the lower part of Orion's skirt doesn't seem to be there.
Gotcha.
So like he was like maybe in the middle of carving it when he freaked out.
Yeah, that could have been the thing that made him freak out.
Sure. Yeah.
So Teddy describes why it's men who, I guess I'm going to call the masks, because why not? They're essentially Reavers from Firefly. They're crazy. They kill people. They do all sorts of horrible things.
They've gone mad from Wyatt's teaching, which I think is interesting.
Right.
In light of Dr. Ford's narrative and what we think he's trying to do with it.
Yeah, so I mean, if Wyatt is supposed to be one of the people who's developed consciousness, then this sort of madness that he's talking about is just basic consciousness.
Yeah, that's being spread by like verbal commands or, you know, who knows, like just random ruminations. Like, because, you know, Abernathy thought about this picture for a full day before he lost his mind. Maybe his woodcarver started carving his constellations and that jogged something.
Mm-hmm. And we get a little more history with Wyatt. Then they find some rotting men tied to a tree, and they're shot at from the ridges. Some of them go back to town, but Teddy continues on with the guest that's with him.
I did like the slightly hacky dialogue. You know, like they're riding down a trail. This is like video game dialogue when the characters are talking to themselves, and they're just dispensing backstory while you're riding from point A to point B. And it was noticeably not up to the show's standards, but I thought that felt like, yeah, this is just an old-timey Western narrative, and it's not particular refined dialogue or even a great performance by any of these people that I know are capable of doing it. It's just NPC. It's NPC chatter, right?
Right.
Which,
especially,
if you don't
always
know,
coming from the sheriff.
I should have explained this, because not everybody plays video games, but NPC, non-player character. It's the guys, you know, because your character is largely silent through most of this shit.
Mm-hmm.
It's just stuff that they want you to know.
Yeah. So I'm super curious about why does Ford give Teddy this particular backstory? Because if we believe that he's given him a story about a man who has developed consciousness, what's he getting at there with Teddy? Is he trying to tell Teddy that this is the path? Is he performing an experiment with Teddy to see if he will realize it?
Is he trying to prepare the world to deal with Ed Harris?
You mean the park?
Yeah. Because if from a certain point of view, and I don't know if I'm down with the man in black being a guest, or if he is a former host that has somehow broken the bonds and gotten his freedom, but you know, I honestly don't know because it seems like it's just a parable of what's actually happening.
Right?
How does that help Teddy? How does that help any of the hosts?
Kind of what I'm getting at is Ford like leaving breadcrumbs for other people,
sure,
to find,
right,
to discover what he's doing, and if so, why? Because you're right, it doesn't seem to have any value to Teddy beyond what we as an audience get from it.
So if we are wrong about Ford's motivations, and Ford is actually trying to continue to press forward with these realistic robots, but he's come up to a hard line where any more real and they're going to develop consciousness, and in fact that this level of verisimilitude, they're already accidentally developing consciousness by casting characters who are hearing the voice of God and deciding this land belongs to them as the villain.
Mm-hmm.
Is he actually putting another subtle layer of control to where the on-script robots will see any robot that tries to lead uprising, mm-hmm. because they're become sentient as villainous and try to kill them? Like, it's a weird kind of underlying sophisticated safeguard against the very thing that he's trying to do.
Maybe, but why get so sophisticated? Why try and kind of do an end run around QA with it. Like, QA can go out there, put a saw in their neck and take them back to the lab and decommission them if they go off the reservation. He doesn't need that mechanism. He's already got a mechanism for
and
control.
And also, they've got the true Samaritan reflex. I don't know. That's just an idea that I had, because it would be kind of an interesting layer. Like, if he's trying to push the boundaries and he's like, okay, it's inevitable that 10% of these hosts are going to go and break.
Right.
They're going to break through this veil of artificiality.
So it's like an optimization.
And the Samaritan reflex isn't good enough to handle, like, an intelligent, conscious thing that I'm going to have this backstory where all the robots see something like that as inherently evil, mm-hmm. so that they will stop it within their scripted selves.
Right.
I don't know. That's kind of interesting. I still don't Maybe. Have a great handle on that. And also,
I mean, self-correcting in any system is
good.
Usually a good thing.
Yeah.
It certainly optimizes, right? It's more
sure.
efficient.
Right.
So maybe.
And it's also less prone. It's something the robots are coming up with themselves internally and not something that's like right. direct code or something like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But that grants that Dr. Ford is actually not trying to liberate the robots. He wants them to
Which
be.
Which I don't know that I agree with.
But
yeah.
if you take his words at face value, it's exactly right. what he's saying. Like, he's all for more realistic robots, but he thinks letting them gain consciousness is a fool's errand. Or even granting
right.
them human consciousness is a
yeah,
fool's
Yeah, there's
errand.
Something about Anthony Hopkins' lion face that I don't believe it.
It's the Hector Lannable. Or God damn
what?
It. Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
Speaking of my sauce, I just bear all my software flaws.
Okay, let's move on. Elsie and Stubbs are tracking the stray, and Stubbs realizes that the symbols on the carvings are the constellation Orion. And they asked the same question I'm asking in this particular scene. Where is the stray going? So he sees stars. He's carving them. And they seem to almost be some kind of map.
Well, I mean, that's, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the navigation that we used to do as human beings was based largely on stars.
Well, that's like, so if you go back to this bicameral mind ancient man concept, one of the reasons the ancient man were interested in the stars is because they quickly realized that they're useful for navigation, they're useful for prediction of seasons and when years are coming to close, because they understand all of the orbital mechanics involved.
Right.
But, you know, we're pattern matching machines, and we see these stars rotate into the sky when it's about to get cold. Like, that's all useful information to have. So if you are trying to make the analogy that these robots are at the bicameral primitive mindset, maybe them paying attention to astronomy is another kind of nod in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that they are maybe not worshiping the stars, but they're realizing some kind of significance with them.
Yeah, could be. So then Bernard goes to see Ford, who is in the process of humiliating a tech who has covered a naked host. Bernard asks to speak in private, and they go to his office where Ford explains, or rather Bernard explains to Ford that a couple of the hosts were hearing the same imaginary voices coming from, or referencing a man named Arnold.
Right.
And Bernard kind of demands the truth from Ford, and Ford tells him about his former business partner, Arnold, who helped develop the park originally, and how Arnold wanted to create consciousness, and how he died.
Well,
doesn't tell him how he died.
I was going to say, for someone who demanded a full truth, he got half-truths and fabrications. And
yeah.
And also, I think it's interesting. First of all, when he says, you know, when what was it? When the legend becomes more interesting than the truth, you print a legend.
Right.
Which is that something from The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is a classic John Ford film, which,
yeah.
you know, this, I think, is another way of paying homage to how much they're borrowing from his work.
Mm-hmm.
But he's essentially saying that what you thought you knew about the park and its early history is a lie. I think it's very plausible that Anthony Hopkins, or I'm sorry, Dr. Ford's character, is saying that, or what he's telling Bernard now is also a fictionalized version of the real truth. Like, it'd be easy enough for Dr. Ford to substitute, what's the other creator?
Arnold.
Like, what if you know, Arnold believed what Anthony Hopkins believes now, and Anthony Hopkins believes what Bernard believed, and
okay.
he died, and he's free since no one's there to remember, and the board's not interested in asking those questions. Like, he's free to just say, oh, that was his cross to bear, not mine. Mm-hmm. And reality, that's the stuff that he's still trying to work for.
Right.
And there's also a sinister, like, if you keep going down that, it's possible that Dr. Ford intentionally had Arnold killed because Arnold didn't want the robots to develop consciousness. And, you know, he engineered a situation because he said, well, it was an accident, but he was far too careful for some kind of accident to happen. That almost either he committed suicide by robot or he was murdered by robot.
Right.
Right? That's what we're getting at?
Well, I thought you were suggesting a moment ago that, like, let's say, for instance, in this scene, that the story is mostly true and that Arnold is the guy who was striving for consciousness in these bots.
Right.
And that Dr. Ford was always, you know, not against it per se, but more in the camp of we don't need that.
Yeah.
And has gradually become... Or gradually, as it happened, became more and more against it.
Right. This is the last thing we want these. Because
Now flip those physical people and say Arnold was killed, but Arnold was actually Dr. Ford.
Yes.
And that Dr. Ford lived on, but Dr. Ford was the guy who was working toward the consciousness.
Yes.
Okay. I thought that's what you were saying.
Yeah, that is.
These two people are, in fact, the opposite people from the story.
Yes. Not physically. I don't think he literally changed identities. He's free to substitute whatever philosophy he wanted.
Uh-huh.
Because nobody knows the real truth. I don't know. I think that's interesting. If
and then all of his words are there to camouflage the fact that he's still actively working toward that.
He's hiding in plain sight,
right.
Essentially. And he's only telling Bernard this because Bernard's demanding answers, so he's giving him the answers that he thinks Bernard would want to hear.
Right. And he's kind of been working in secret at this point to develop consciousness. Maybe like, you know, because some event happened, right? So there was some kind of event around Arnold's death. I think personally it might have been like he actually did succeed in his mission to develop consciousness in one of these bots, and then the shit broke bad.
Yeah, robots developed insanity as well. And because you see...
And killed him.
You know, there's a lot of things we see. We see there's this blonde character that I'm going to call as an old-timey prostitute, and they're teaching them how to dance with the robots. And then as he's saying that the robots develop consciousness, he's linking that to madness, and you see the technician interviewing this woman, and she's scratched her face all up, which seems like something a person that's not operating at peak mental abilities would do.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also – something also interesting I wanted to point out is that's the same character that we see as Hector's right-hand woman.
Right.
Yeah. Who's got – what I've since learned in research is a snake tattoo on her face, which is interesting in light of the prophecy that was given by the little Latina girl that was Lawrence's daughter.
Yeah.
Who said that you need to seek the maze by the blood red arroyo where the snake lays its eggs. I don't know how this, you know, that so you got a lady with a snake tattoo. I don't know how she lays eggs and all that stuff, but there is a little bit of imagery coming together there.
Sure. I don't know exactly where it's going.
What do you think of Dr. Ford's office? Like he's essentially sitting in the middle of the House of Black and White from, or the basement of the House of Black and White from Game of Thrones. He's got all these faces on his wall. He's got some dude that's playing a player piano in the background. Mm-hmm. I thought it was kind of creepy / cool.
Yeah, I did. That's my exact feeling on it.
The other thing is creepy / cool. How about the young Anthony Hopkins?
That was amazing.
Like,
it looks really good.
I mean, what they did, it makes what they did with Jeff Bridges in the Tron movie mm-hmm. look like a bad joke. And I thought that was fairly impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, that was so fucking convincing.
No, it was a super short sequence. I mean,
it was a super short sequence.
He's on screen maybe 3 seconds.
And they were using kind of a sepia tone effect to kind of suggest this was like old, a little bit, is a little desaturated. So they had a lot of tricks that they were using, but I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, it looked great.
And I wonder if that was actually Anthony Hopkins acting and they did some kind of digital de-aging of him, or if that was an entirely CG Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm trying to put together what Ford's motivation here. Okay, let's say that Ford is not Arnold and Arnold is not Ford, that this story is more true than we want to believe.
Uh-huh.
So Arnold develops consciousness. That consciousness kills him in bot form. And so that's the incident that they're talking about.
All right.
That happened 30 years ago or whatever.
We don't know that those incidents are the same.
No, we don't. We don't. But I'm gonna go that direction with it.
All right. Run with it, baby.
If that's true, we could be seeing Ford near the end of his life changing his mind on what Arnold was doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the plain reading that you've got if you go with all the other theories.
I mean, the plain reading is Ford isn't trying to develop consciousness, but clearly his actions, he's taking are...
The first level sub-reading is that he has been, as the ruminations of an old man thinking about his partner and 30 years ago... And nagging, and also the fact that it seems like maybe Ford is dissatisfied with the way this park has developed.
Mm-hmm.
Like that in the early days, they were just doing this creative work and like they wanted to show it off to people. But the fact that, because he said that, you know, his partner was wrong about two things. You know, number one, you're creating crazy robots. And number two, this park and what it's become, the last thing you want is your host to be conscious because they're just being playthings for these people to live out their power fantasies.
Right.
And his rebuke of Lee's character seems like that whether he intended that or not, he is dissatisfied that that is what the park has become.
Right. Yep. I don't know. But he does tell Bernard not to make the same mistake as Arnold and invokes his son in it. I know the death of your son Charlie still weighs heavily on you.
Which kind of connects what Bernard is doing with the desire to somehow have a hope of reconnecting with the son. I don't know exactly how, whether he's going to make a robot version of his son. I know a lot of people had the theory that we briefly talked about that robot boy that Anthony Hopkins met last episode was essentially a younger version of him.
Right.
Which I don't know. Maybe. I don't. So far, that's just a theory and it doesn't have any really probative value.
Right. I guess it could be that direct. I thought it was more of like an indirect thing to kind of nurture a thing or to...
He says, you mustn't make Arnold's mistake. And he says, why would I? And he says, well, I know your death, your son weighs heavy. Well, how is that connected?
I don't think he's trying to necessarily physically recreate his son.
Yeah.
I think he more has a desire to nurture a thing, which could result in him nurturing this consciousness in these robots.
Yeah, but then if you in isolation, yes, but immediately this scene follows with the conversation he has with his ex, I think, wife.
Right.
Where she says they talk about the unreality of this of their son being dead as parents and how it just doesn't seem real. And Bernard makes a statement that the pain of losing him is all that I have left that makes it feel real. I don't know. I feel like these things are connected and they go together. That this is supposed to help us understand Bernard's motivation for doing what he's doing to Dolores and why. I mean,
I just don't think it's that direct. Physical
it could be
connection.
that he's trying to
more of an emotional thing.
Yeah, and also it could be that we're supposed to connect the fact that he's seeing this as like a proto daughter, or like he this is another creative works that this is
that's what I'm getting.
This
at.
Is a as an intellectual offspring of his.
That's exactly what I'm
getting at.
Because
he also makes a direct connection between his relationship with the son and how he feels about letting Dolores go and, you know, sink or swim. So, yeah, that's a pretty good reading, too.
But I don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing how all of this plays out in subsequent episodes. Did you know that this may be a spoiler alert. I don't know if people want to skip ahead 10 seconds, but it's an interesting fact. Episode 10 is going to be called The Bicameral Mind.
Huh. I don't think that's a spoiler. That's just information, man.
Just information. So we kind of talked about this scene with Zoe from Firefly, where Bernard's talking with her on a screen about their dead child. Is there anything interesting to the idea that this might tell us a little more about where Westworld is? Because they do say it's very difficult to get a connection out here.
Well,
making it seem like the park is very, very far away.
I mean, I had people suggesting, both in Reddit and in my inbox, that this is taking place on Mars.
That's okay. And where do you think Zoe is?
Earth, I guess. But I mean,
that's
this
not
is...
physically possible.
Why?
Because there's no delay.
Oh, right.
there would absolutely have to be a delay in communication.
They've invented faster light travel.
Right. Now, if we're going down that rabbit hole.
I mean, who knows? But that's looking glass. That's a great point. And also, I just find I don't care. Like, if Westworld is all underground, if Westworld is in the Southwest, if Westworld's on Mars, if Westworld's in a space station, like, so far that's not mattered. So,
right.
You know, I don't choose. I mean, I find that kind of level of, it's kind of like also, like, you know, people getting hung up on the sim munitions and their capabilities. Like, that also is not very interesting to me.
Sure.
If, like, unless a theory tells us something about the world,
right,
then I don't care.
Yeah.
So, and the more tenuous the theory is, the less I'm willing to entertain it.
Yeah, and honestly, like, even if we found out it was on Mars, that tells us something about the physical world that they're living in, but
sure.
It doesn't say anything thematically about the show.
Not really.
So, it really doesn't influence my opinion on it one way or another.
Right.
And I guess I'm with you. I don't really care all that much, although it would be cool, I guess, from a sci-fi kind of perspective, if it were
somewhere
other
tell
than
us,
just in the desert.
It would tell us they can do real-time communications
right.
in faster-than-light information travel, which would put
which
them...
changes the game.
It changes the game quite a bit. But yeah. On the other hand, like, you know, they've got these really sophisticated biological AI robots. Like, yeah, like I said, I just don't find it super interesting at this point. It might become interesting later, and then I guess you guys get all the internet points in the world for calling Mars, but...
Right.
Yeah.
They're also calling it because there's, I think it was maybe downstairs in cold storage, there's a globe which has the Westworld, the word Westworld printed across it, but the continents are not anything
right.
near what we see on Earth.
Right.
So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know what
I
to make
know.
Of, I don't know what to make of all that. And, you know, it's great to note, like, I haven't forgotten any of this information, but mm-hmm. I just don't know what to do with it right now.
Right. Okay. Elsie and Stubbs find the stray stuck in a crevice. In a rock formation there.
A lot of zombie imagery. Did you not feel like this guy was shot like a zombie from Night of the Living Dead? And also
oh, yeah.
the guy's nailed
yeah.
to the tree that kind of came back to life.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to have like a Halloween zombie episode in a week or two?
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah, you're always open for that.
Let's do it. Why not?
Taking it to The Walking Dead.
All those faces on Ford's wall come alive.
Sure. Start gnawing on him.
I suppose there's no reason they couldn't start talking, yeah?
Well, so, I mean, that's, yeah, because when I first saw that, like, I thought instead of just coughing, the person said, like, boo or something. And I'm like, that's weird. So, like, were those robots supposed to be dead? And
oh, I think that's all for effect. I think this is part
yeah,
of
yeah,
Lee's
yeah.
storyline.
Okay, sure.
He's like, let's have a cough in their face when it wakes up, and that'll scare the shit out of them, and then
right.
shoot at them.
But this is also Ford's storyline.
This is?
No, what? Oh, no, not this, but the guy nailed to the tree, that's part of Ford's new narrative. They're after this Wyatt character who is in Platts. That's definitely part of Ford's narrative.
Oh, I suppose you're right.
He says
he
it's a small part of his narrative, but
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah,
so, yeah, I don't
small.
Think that's Lee's shit at all.
Okay, good. We haven't seen Lee this entire episode. We don't
he
see
got,
him.
He got his walking papers and his walk. Ford got his walking boots. He got his walking papers.
No, he'll be back.
Yeah, I'm sure he will.
Okay, let's talk real quickly about VR.
Okay.
Because we have hypothesized that some of this might be taking place in VR.
But this makes no sense.
Zero.
Them
sense.
Tracking this robot in physical space. Makes,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
A
so
blow,
can
a blow
we put that
the VR?
Can we put that theory to rest? I think we can. It would be insane to have elevators into a world that you then have to walk across
sure.
a fucking tundra to get.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's pretty good evidence. The fact that they didn't say, okay, the other thing is, I guess the blow from the Westworld's underground, which, god damn it, I don't find interesting, I don't care about, because, what'd you say the guy's name was? Tubbs?
Tubbs, yeah. Stubbs.
Yeah, Crockett and Tubbs are out
Ashley
looking
Stubbs.
For him. He mentions that they're getting satellite imagery. And that's how they're tracking this guy, which my first thought is, why the fuck can't they just track him? Like, do they not
right.
really have GPS locks on every one of these droids?
They should.
Yeah. So I would say that this proves VR, but they're also, I don't feel like that they give a shit about the precise nature of how this technology works either. Like, they don't, like, Jonathan Nolan does not care about the simunitions. Jonathan Nolan does not care about whether this is real or virtual space. He's wanting to tell the story that has nothing to do with that. So, like, maybe some of this stuff is contradictory just so people don't fixate on it. I mean, that's a curious decision for a showrunner to make, but...
Yeah, I don't know. I just think people are speculating wildly, and we don't have enough information to come to a solid conclusion yet.
Yeah.
But I feel like there probably is one. They probably have something in their mind, and maybe there are small contradictions, but there's probably an idea. So Teddy's group encounter Wyatt's masked men. Teddy sends the guest running and distracts the masks until they kill him.
Ah, love that little fanfire moment.
That's so cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this. Do those guns affect... Does his shots affect these masks?
Well, so Teddy, in his NPC dialogue, mentioned that these guys do not fear death and are conditioned to not feel pain. Mm-hmm. So it could be that, like, I guess it's like the, you know, the guy huffed up or all hopped up on PCP. Like, you know, they take multiple bullets, but they keep coming because they're not feeling the pain. And until you actually physically disable them with a shot to their arteries or something, I feel like it's ambiguous because his dialogue says that maybe they're capable of that. Because it's not like that he got shot and 3 days later they're still marching through the desert. He shot them as they were advancing within melee range, and then they all just kind of collapsed onto him.
Okay.
Like, you know, so it's like, I don't...
And if these are hosts, they could certainly be programmed to not react the same way as the other hosts, right? To be the scary monsters in the mountain that no one can kill.
Right. So, I feel like that you... Maybe some of these guys are going to, quote-unquote, die... But Teddy just, you know, you'd have to shoot him in the head maybe to disable him. And it looked like he gave him all gut shots.
Yeah. It was cool, though.
He was cool. He's really very, fired that. I never, I guess, appreciated how skilled Teddy was with a gun until this episode. Because he's always just seen as this joke.
Mm-hmm. So Elsie calls Bernard to explain what happened with the stray. Bernard talks with Dolores again. And he struggles with whether he's made a mistake that he should correct or let her continue to evolve.
Because obviously,
ultimately, he decides to let her continue.
Ford's talk made him doubt himself.
Yes, right. Which what is about, strange because I think Ford is working toward the same goal. But
and why did Dolores' talk? Like, what did she say that made him feel like that? It's weird because he seems so convinced by Ford's conversation, and then Dolores reconvinced him. So if he goes back to talk to Ford, like, you know, like, what is his true mind?
She says, "I think when I discover who I am, I'll be free." And I think that's the thing that triggers him, his understanding that this is more than they've programmed and that this could be...
And that she deserves to make this choice?
This could... Right, yeah. Like, he doesn't want to take that away from something that may or may not be, in fact, conscious. Especially after he's got this information from Ford that that's what Arnold was working on.
Right. And he plagiarizes Ford's dialogue from the previous episode about the evolution and being, you know, just a series of mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And then again,
and he thinks he's made a mistake, or he questions, "Have I made a mistake?"
Right.
And he's going to let that mistake lie. Just let it be.
Well, also the fact that he's like, I think what he really appreciates is that because they imply that Dolores is no longer being reset, or at least not fully. That like you have to promise me you're going to stay on your loop, even though you are becoming aware that bad things are happening to you.
Right.
And he's like, you know, if you had two versions of yourself, one that was aware and one that was blissfully unaware, it's kind of like the red pill versus blue pill.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, doesn't say one way or another, but kind of like, I kind of want to keep exploring this to find out which of those I prefer. And then he immediately draws a connection between his son and her, like implying that he considers her almost a child of his now.
Right.
Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's why he can't bring himself to destroy what he's created here.
Right. And he says stay in your loop not because that's what's good for her, but that's what she needs to do to survive. Because if she goes, you know, AWOL, then they're going to hunt her down and hack out her control unit, which apparently involves severing their heads.
Right.
What the fuck? That seems like that was just for sensationalism, right?
Yeah, it's rather silly. And honestly, I don't know why that robot smashes his own head in. If this is part of the psychosis that that the bots were experiencing when Arnold experimented with them, it seems like maybe it is.
I think he was caught between because we see this pyramid. There was memories, improvisation. One was self-interest, right?
Yeah.
He was caught between his programming to not harm, like the self-preservation, which is if he's going to survive as this creature, he's got to escape and terminate these. But also his higher level program that forbids him from harming a guest.
Right.
And he split the difference by bashing his own head in.
Because
he didn't want to, like, I won't become a slave. You know, you won't take me alive, but I also can't hurt you to get what I really want. So he locked up and bashed his own brains in. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, no, it was cool. I guess I would not program these bots the same way that they are apparently programmed. Like, let's move on to the final scene, okay, where Dolores is in the park. The guys who escaped the masks right into town, and Dolores finds out Teddy's probably not coming back. She goes back to the farm where the milk bottle bandits are doing their thing. They drag her to the barn, and she grabs the gun of the bandit. She's unable to shoot him until she sees a vision of the previous encounter with the man in black, and she then shoots this guy. And after killing him, she rides off on a horse.
But throughout the scene, she's also realizing the nature of her loop, because she's picking out things the milk bandit saying, like, oh, there's nobody, your daddy and no gunslinger here to protect you tonight, which kind of implies that that milk gang bandit is becoming aware of his loop, too.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Because the daddy is one thing, but gunslinger, like, what the fuck? Right. Like, Teddy's not there. In his mind, Teddy would never be there, but he's accessed these reveries. And
is there any chance it's like a reference to part of their
backstory? You know what? No, fuck it. I mean, yes, it's also referenced earlier this same day. Teddy scared them off.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So, duh. Yeah. that is kind of obvious.
But what
he said does jog her, because mm-hmm. she repeats it to him and he slaps her, and then she finds the courage to change her programming when she sees fragments of the memory of the man in black confronting her.
Right. I mean, this is a huge moment both for Dolores and also for this episode, because it brings together the concept of bicameral mind into with all three things, right? Self-interest, the memory, and also the
improvisation,
which I don't know that Bernard ever put her back into script mode.
That's a good, so glad you remembered to say that, because I had it in my notes to point it out that he puts her in analysis mode. Now, I mean, it's like he also
into improv mode.
Yes. In improvisation only. So I don't know whether we're supposed to think that when he led her back to the floor, that he probably did that and we just didn't see it.
Maybe.
Or we're supposed to understand he made a mistake on top of what he's already trying to do. Maybe this is the key to allow her to.
Yeah, I didn't even think maybe it's just a straight up mistake. Like, he meant to turn her back.
Right.
And then just forgot.
Yeah.
That would certainly play into the theme. But the other thing cool that's happening here is this bicameral mind is going on the screen, because we hear Bernard say, kill him, shoot him, whatever he says.
Is it Bernard? Because I think it's kind of ambiguous.
It is ambiguous, but the voices that she has heard in the past, I think, have been Bernard.
Right. But we're recontextualizing this with, because we've been wondering, who is this? So if you take the bicameral mind theory, these are not Bernard's words.
Right.
These are her own thoughts that are coming from who she views as the god figure. And she's putting it in her, but these are actually her own thoughts.
Yeah.
We were thinking these are some kind of embedded commands, but if you understand the bicameral mind theory correctly, no, those are all coming from within her. These are things that she wants to do.
Yeah, which is why I really love the end of this episode.
Yes.
I think it brings it all together so nicely. Puts a bow on it. And I don't know. So I did want to talk about how I would program them differently. Why are they even able to overwrite those core programming, that core programming that they
have?
Well,
I mean,
like, when QA says we don't want them to be able to shoot guns, does that mean we'll put a line somewhere in the routine that says that? Or does that mean physically hardwire these fucks so they can't shoot guns?
Because
you can physically
hardwire
them.
No, it would have to be software, because these guys are reused all the time. And this is something that they just... You know,
yeah, but you swap out a chip, you do whatever. I mean, we could do that today pretty easily.
But on the other hand, it's obvious to me from feedback that we've gotten. We got one from a scientist that works at the Large Hadron Collider, who's done a lot of AI and neural network research. And he essentially said the same thing, only much more authoritatively, that we got from the Wired article last week, which is... It's a simplistic mistake to think in terms of just debugging and line by line and logic loops when you're talking about neural network.
Right.
So it could be that they're doing the best they can and they weren't aware of this, of this possibility. And now it's staring them in the face. Now, what is Elsie going to do with this new information? Because I don't think she's going to sit still.
No, I mean, she was clearly off on that horse for not just to escape the ranch,
right.
But I think she's trying to escape at all.
Oh, no, I'm talking about Elsie, the technician.
Oh, Elsie. I thought you meant Dolores.
No, yeah. it's a reasonable mistake to make to think that I would make that mistake. But no, I think Elsie, like, if she was already on to something bizarre here, right. And now the tension is Dr. Ford ain't going to want to see this narrative come to the close. Uh-huh. The board isn't going to want to see this narrative come to a close.
Bernard's not.
Is she going to be silenced? Like, is she? I mean, how do you sit still when a robot almost kills you and then you watch it bash its brains in some kind of weird robotic gridlock?
Right. And now Dolores has done something she's programmed to not be able to do.
And are they going to know about that? Is Bernard going to cover it up? Like,
right. I would think Elsie could find it out. I mean, she can pull all the information she needs.
Like I said, I don't buy the theory that the man in black is William 30 years ago, but it is interesting that they reveal to us what he said to her when he drug her to the barn, which is let's take things back to the beginning. And then the mm-hmm. final scene is Dolores stumbling off the ranch and into William's arms.
Right.
Again, I don't think that is
so
literally...
So is she seeing the future? Like, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, so that's another thing we're going to talk about in the feedback. The fact that her memory of her loop almost works as a form of premonition. Because she saw...
Right, but it's not actual premonition. So, like, the reason it works as premonition is because everybody's on a loop, right? And so the things she's seeing have happened in the past.
Right, like...
But they can't predict the future in this case because they're all on a loop.
So there's one person that wrote in to me wanting to know what I made of the fact that Dolores was shot and then she wasn't shot. And he's like, does that mean that she's become kind of like, quote-unquote, human because she can ignore... I suggest that she had a memory of being shot
right.
and knew what was going to happen
right.
and then took steps to prevent it.
Which, if you believe that, then she has the memory of the man in black
right.
not seeing the future man in black, which would have to be 30 years from now because William is the man in
black.
But
there's significant... That
makes no sense.
Wait a second, what?
So if she rides off that ranch
uh-huh.
into William's arms when...
Right.
He's White Hat William.
Yeah.
And then 30 years from now, he becomes the man in black. Well, then that man in black vision would have to be a premonition, not just a memory.
Well, but you're granting...
Because William hasn't happened yet.
Well, but what I guess is they're saying that there was some... So Ed Harris says, let's take it back to the beginning, implying that maybe she's done this twice before. Like, we're seeing the first time she did it, or a similar condition with William, and then 30 years later she's doing it again because she remembered... I'm trying to defend the theory I don't believe.
Right.
But I'm trying to do my best that I don't think that there's necessarily a contradiction. They would just have to be really actively fooling us as far as this. Which
They'd have to be really playing tricks on us.
Which means the payoff better be awesome, because I don't like that as a viewer. I don't like it when they are deliberately misleading me. They can withhold information, but to shoot things in a deliberately deceptive way, I think...
And that would be super deceptive to shoot from 30 years in the future and say, now we're jumping back in the exact same scene into the past 30 years.
And your only clue is a logo change.
Right.
Which can be explained
there will probably be more and more clues, I imagine, later on.
Yeah,
if it was the case,
but like I said, the payoff would have to be pretty big for me not to be kind of annoyed by that. But but I don't know. Like I said, it seems like people are – well, I mean, the show's inviting you to try to figure out these mysteries. It's just like, if you get down a path, it's like, okay, well, what if it is a loop? What does that tell us? What is that going to – how is that going to influence your analysis going forward? Like, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. So right now she sort of has the ability of premonition, but as more and more of the hosts become
conscious,
it would be less and less effective, yeah.
In fact, if she's going off strip, she's leaving her loop the way I see it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Like, what is, people are going to find this out. She's going to be astray when she doesn't report to her pre-planned milk dropping point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how is this going? And Elsie's not going to have any, not going to want to hear any of these excuses. Like, I like the fact that show seems like on a weekly basis to build it into situations where you're like, man, how do they get out? How do they go from here? How do they resolve? How do you have a 10 episode season still in Westworld when it looks like in episode 4, the prudent thing would be shut this shit down?
Well, I mean, the people at the top who, the people at the top are the ones pushing this forward. So it's difficult to do an end run around them if you're Elsie, right?
Well, no, I mean, I'm not saying
go
Elsie,
to Teresa,
but like,
go to the board and say they're fucking with things.
And obviously they don't want to give refunds because, you know, we even address that how, but do you know what they really don't want to do is deal with deaths at their park and you know, wrongful death lawsuits. And I mean, maybe we're supposed to believe that these terms of service are so ironclad that you can't be sued. But to me,
and more so, they don't want to shut the park down.
Also, like, I don't feel like that indemnifies them against negligence. Mm-hmm. And if they knowingly, like, you know, you're supposed to, like, they're telling you in the terms and conditions, like, the host won't hurt you, but you could die because of your own dumbass shit. You know, run in front of buffaloes, or you try to shove a tumbleweed up your ass. Those are going to go badly for you. Well, if the park knows that their hosts can now possibly kill people and don't do that, just. And don't shut it down just because of their greed. That seems like a great way for a judge and jury to throw out the waiver that you signed because you didn't have full. If the waiver said our host can kill you, and we are reasonably certain that that might happen, nobody signs that.
Right.
So, like, those terms and conditions are only valid if you are agreeing to everything in advance that can happen to you. So,
yeah.
How do they
so
proceed? How do they keep this covered up? I mean,
well, so far, I mean, nothing like that has happened, right? There are no hosts dead, or there are no guests dead, rather. It's something is happening that's unexpected,
so you
but
think
nothing
Teresa
tragic
and Abort,
has happened.
Yeah,
I don't think Teresa. I think Teresa might want to shut this stuff down.
Right.
But the board also is exerting pressure on her to keep the park open and operational.
If they're going to play that, I feel like we need to see more of this board, too. Yeah. Like, they need to become characters that I can gauge their motivations.
Well, they can't show you it because Ed Harris is on the board. That's why.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's much younger looking, Ed Harris.
He is.
That
yeah,
would, that,
it's been 30
that
years
would
ago.
Really flip people's weird brains.
Right. Okay. So Stubbs climbs down to cut the head off the stray, and it wakes up and threatens to kill Elsie before bashing its own brains in with a rock.
Well, see,
I don't
that's
know exactly
that's...
why it happened. But
that is interpretation, because I looked – I actually did some freeze-frame analysis on his face. He raised the rock. I don't know that you can necessarily – he's clearly distraught, but I don't
– well, threatens to kill, is, in my mind, looks like it. His intent is to kill.
But I don't know
that is true of the screen – of what you see there. His – it appears that his intent is to come after Elsie. Certainly she thinks that.
That's certainly her interpretation as well, but then he then goes and bashes his own brain in. So it could be that he just was putting himself out of this torment as
well. Oh, sure.
And he never intended
to
kill her.
Right, that's...
I just want to make sure we're not
true, but
leading the...
Elsie certainly feels threatened here, yeah?
Oh, yeah, I would too.
Okay.
But I'm saying if you actually look at it, the actual evidence is, you know, silent on his intent.
Sure.
I mean, he definitely looks crazy, and he's bloody, and he's screaming, but, you know, like, and you
Well, can... he does harm to...
He shoves him.
Stubbs.
He shoves him.
Elbows him in his dick or something. I don't know. He incapacates him for a while.
But I think you can get in fist fights with robots. Like, they're allowed to do that. They're just not allowed to kill you.
I guess so.
You know, I mean, they're allowed to shoot you and put a bruise on your shoulder, so...
Mm-hmm. And then William and Logan are sitting by a campfire when Dolores rides up.
Yep.
And that's it.
There you go.
That's the end of the episode. I don't know where it goes from here. I think William might try to help her. I don't know if escape is the right word there, but...
And what's Logan
run.
Do?
I don't know. He probably wants to fuck her or something.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, there was a lot of speculation about, like, you know, William and Logan coming to heads here. Mm-hmm. Does Dolores have her... No, Dolores does not have her real gun. We speculate is a real gun.
I don't think so, yeah.
Now, the other thing that kind of supports this time loop is, you know, clearly she stole this gun. It's nice and shiny. I didn't see if they're the same make and model, but if she buried, if at the result of this, that she, as a result of this arc, she buries a gun on her family farm, 30 years later, it would look kind of that shitty and corroded, right? When she digs it out of the ground.
Right. So in my mind, it's impossible that there isn't a connection between the picture and the gun.
Huh.
So I don't think that's going to happen. I think the gun was left there by whoever left the picture as well.
Oh.
because they're both buried. They're both in roughly the same spot. You gotta, like, I imagine that those are connected, but...
Because I thought the picture was just, like, maybe fell out of someone's pocket when they were doing the ride. But it was also buried, Abernathy.
Just like...
Was it buried? I thought, but it was sticking up.
Right, but the gun wasn't very deep either.
Yeah, but it wasn't, like, jutting out of the ground.
No, but I would say they were both in stages of burial.
I'd have to go back, but my memory was it wasn't really buried. It was just kind of, like, wedged down there and, like, some dirt had... You know, been kicked up by the horses or whatever.
Okay, I mean that's fine. But they're evoking the same thing to me. Like
I grant you that, like, that's thematically a perfectly valid way to interpret it. Is that maybe more invalid that someone's actually there's an external influence that's fucking with Dolores. It could be Bernard or it could be the Man in Black or
right.
You know, because he also comes back and says, let's go take it back to the beginning. Maybe the Man in Black's doing all this because this is part of the game he's trying to play.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Before we mosey on down to the feedback section, head away from the Sweetwater portion of the podcast into the rough and tumble, you might get hurt, you might get stampeded section that we call feedback. You might wonder how two guys can spend 2.5 hours talking about Westworld each week and Halt and Catch Fire and American Horror Story and Walking Dead, which we just started our podcast for this week and it's going to be going hot and heavy starting next week. Well, the answer is we do this as our full-time job, and we do that primarily. You notice we don't do a lot of advertising, or at least external advertising. We do it primarily through direct listener support. People see the value of having our independent voices and podcasts, bringing this information to them and recording it, and they see they have it in their hearts to support us. And they can do that at club.baldmove.com. And it's not entirely altruistic. You get some special features. For one thing, you get ad-free podcasts. You get expanded bonus features. We do like weekly call-in shows like Lunch with Jim and Aaron. We do Bald Movies where we do a spoiler-filled review of current run movies. Do a lot of other different stuff. There's VIP access to the forums. Explore all those features and find out how you can support Bald Move at club.baldmove.com. Also, Amazon. If you're an Amazon shopper, easy way to support us is to go to amazon.baldmove.com for all of your shopping needs. That takes you right to Amazon. You got the same experience from that point forward. It doesn't cost you anything. That's the brilliant part. This is money that we're prying out of Bezos' live, warm fingers. He's not cold nor dead. We're just prying him out a penny at a time. And we get a surprising amount of our operating income from people remembering to do that. And all you got to do is just remember to do it. For all those that do support us, we appreciate it. And they're probably not hearing it because they're listening to the ad-free feeds. But we do require it to continue to do what we're doing. Second thing I want to tell you all about is this is the week of the Rocket City NerdCon going down in Huntsville, Alabama. It's this weekend, October 22nd and 23rd. There's a kickoff on Friday at the Yellowhammer Brewing Facility, but we're going to be down there hosting panels. We're going to be doing meeting and greeting. We're running a booth that has some cool contests where you can win some really cool Game of Thrones merch. Saturday evening, we're going to be doing a mock Red Wedding where we're going to be playing a game with audience participation where you can win yet more Game of Thrones themed prizes. We're really looking forward to it. We think it's going to be a lot of fun. And tickets are still available at rocketcitynerdcon.org. Pick one up and say hi to us. And we hope to see you down there.
Anyway, want to get to feedback?
Yeah, let's get to feedback. Ethan B. has a couple of things he wants to run past us. He says, there's this idea that there's the core code of the host that prevents him from causing harm to any living thing, mm-hmm. which can confirm both in Dolores' interrogation with the head of security and the inability of the host to even kill a fly, which, of course, Dolores does later. My question is this. If the host cannot harm a living thing and know they cannot, then how do we explain the motivation of many hosts to do so? Teddy tries to shoot the Man in Black. He can't because, as explained in William's orientation, guns don't work on real people. But that doesn't mean he didn't try. Thus, it was a mechanical construct, the gun, that wouldn't kill the newcomer. The host had intent to harm them all the way. In episode 2, we see a prostitute slap Logan during an orgy scene. We also see the Man in Black, while interrogating Lawrence, get into a gunfight with a slew of Lawrence's cousins. Many shoot at him, and even one tries to tackle him in the doorway. This is clear evidence that the host would harm a newcomer, but they can't. How do we reconcile this with the core code of never harm a living thing? So this is something touched on in the episode, but mm-hmm. it's the idea that these role that, you know, this bicameral mind that the robots have two modes of operation. One, right, which is the unit itself knows on some level it's a robot and it has the good, right, Samaritan reflex. Yep. And it knows that if I shoot this person from this range with this simulated image, I'm going to shoot him in the shoulder. It's not going to hurt them. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to tackle him in the doorway, but it's not going to do reasonable harm. And then the second phase, which is a lower sub or a higher conscious level, which says, I am a gunfighter. This guy just said fighting words to me or stole my girl. I naturally want to try to punch him or shoot them.
Right.
And again, I think it's instructive that Teddy shot the man in black, but when the man in black put his head right on the gun, which might do damage with a simulated round, he couldn't even pull the trigger. So I think that's, you just got to realize that they're operating on two levels of operation, their character and the fact that they themselves are a robot that responds to commands like analyze and improvise, yeah, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Did I miss anything there?
No.
So I don't think, like, I think if, like, Teddy had a knife, which is an example he used later in email. Could he have stabbed the man in black? I don't think he could have. Hmm. He wouldn't. He might threaten the man in black.
Yeah.
He might swing at the man in black with the knife. But there's no way that he would actually physically cut the man in black with the knife.
Right.
Lucas V sent in this promotional poster that the came with some marketing materials with Westworld. It's this, like, a movie-style poster of Teddy and Dolores standing at the edge of a cliff with this beautiful vista, and it says, life without limits, be yourself, we won't tell. Plan your trip at discoverwestworld.com. I'll post this in the show notes, but the interesting thing about it is in the background, there is a literal maze, and they're standing at what can only be described as a blood-red arroyo.
Hmm.
Like a canyon carved out of by water.
Okay.
You know, I don't think that what's interesting is they were, this was all promotional material released before the show, that they were this explicit in some of the things that they were trying to do in the marketing material. But I think that's pretty interesting. It seems like that this maze is going to be a literal place. And then your question is, to what end?
Right. What's in the maze?
Why would you make a maze for either host or guest to find and explore that has some kind of metaphysical significance? Why the prophecy? Like the fact that the little girl gave the prophecy kind of blew my mind last week.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We'll have to see. Brad T said, hey guys, you were talking about Westworld being $40,000 a day, but also happening in the future. One thing you guys forget to take into account is inflation. If you look at today's money, $40,000 in 2016 was only worth about $1,810 in 1916. There's no way inflation would be the same over the next 100 years or so, but using inflation, we could still try to reverse engineer what year it is based on $40,000 still being a lot of money. So I think what they're saying is that we think $40,000 is a lot of money, but it might not be that much money 50 years in the future. Like, instead of $40,000 a day, it might be like $5,000 a day.
Right.
There's hotels that are $5,000
If I were going to get bottle service at a Vegas,
sure,
club, and they said it was $250 for that bottle of vodka, I'd go, holy fuck, that's a lot of money, but not, right, in comparison to, like, but it's not out of the range of what I could potentially afford for a crazy night out, right?
Yeah, if you were like a top of the line white class, white collar worker, if you were upper echelon's a programmer's salary, if you're a doctor, you're a lawyer.
Right.
That's,
it's still a splurge, but it's not unreasonable.
Yeah, it's something like a once on a year treat.
I'm not saving up for a year to get it, but
exactly,
but I won't do it more than once a year.
Exactly. So yeah, like I don't know that you can calculate with $40,000 being a lot of money, because that's a sliding scale, and also inflation's not constant. It averages a couple percentage points a year, like 2 to 3%.
It's 2210. That's the year.
2210. Yeah,
I did the math.
Sure. I said 2024. Clearly wrong. Dave B. I have a theory that Ed Harris is the co-creator of the Westworld technology of Ford. This is one that I hadn't seen before.
And that he is Arnold?
That he is Arnold. He may have sold his side of the IP to Westworld Company for lots of cash and a lifetime pass of Westworld. This would explain how he can afford to go to the park so much. It also explain how he knows the robot so well. The game within a game could be clues he planted for himself when he designed the robots. I find it interesting that the two characters most interested in Westworld are Ford and the Man in Black, who appear to be the two oldest characters, which would lend credence to the theory that they are trying to find a way to live forever with robots.
So,
this was sent in before this weekend's email, but I thought it might. Mm-hmm. I wanted to explore it in the context of what we know now about Arnold.
Okay, so Stubbs.
Yeah?
Who's from QA. Uh-huh. He's seen the Man in Black, knows that he's in the park. And he ostensibly knows a lot about the park, right? He knew that was the second... the second bot ever created that Anthony Hopkins was talking to downstairs. I feel like he would know who that guy is.
But Dr. Ford himself says that nobody now knows that there was two co-creators, there were two founders.
Right.
So like that, if you take him at his word, that would mean that it's not entirely outside the realm of possibility. In fact, it's probable.
But it reveals that secret awfully quickly, if that's the case, but if it's something he's trying to protect.
Bernard's his protege, and maybe he's grooming him to take over. I mean, there's like, you know, like, I don't think he would tell Elsie this. He'd tell Elsie, get back to fucking work. Here, let me carve up a robot's face to let you know I mean business.
Right. I guess, I don't know. I guess I didn't view that as like a closely guarded secret that people have, or that memory had been completely wiped from the record.
Why
but,
do you say
but
that?
But more that it was like, nobody really cares. Like, yeah, we just don't talk about it. Like,
or in fact that we specifically, our propaganda is that I am the creator, that I am the sole genius behind it.
Right, but not couldn't figure it out if you like went through the records,
yeah, I suppose.
Or that the people inside the company wouldn't know.
It'd be like, you know, Walt Disney had a brother, Roy.
Uh-huh.
I don't know
by
that
an animatronic Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, but it's like I don't know, that super common knowledge. And if he had been killed by a mouse or whatever, and Disney decided to bury that, like I guess they could. Something happened 50, 60 years ago, and most people just don't care. Like, you know, how many people have seen Song in the South? That's something Walt Disney has effectively tried to bury and pretend it didn't happen.
I suppose it's possible.
My girlfriend didn't know that movie existed until I showed it to her.
Right.
So,
but it's still out there, and a lot of people still know about it. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Like, it's a thing that the company doesn't talk about and would rather people not talk about or think about. But it's still out there. People know it.
The other thing about this timeline is I feel like people think it's 30 years and have run, like, that's the beginning of the park. But Jonathan Nolan also put out a lot of information that Westworld is far older than the 30 years. That like, or well, at least there's an idea that it could be,
but it can't be. I mean, if you take at face value Anthony Hopkins' age in both the flashback and the current Westworld stuff we see, they look to be about 30 years apart.
However, you also have to put in context what he said in the first episode that they conquered everything but death. So, like, just, you know, if you conquered all disease and genetic deficiencies, like, maybe you could live everyone's living a maximum human lifespan. Instead of dying at 70 or 80, you're dying at 120, 130. That there gives you enough wiggle room to say that I don't know that you could say that was Anthony Hopkins 30 years ago.
Okay.
Because he doesn't look
130 to me.
But that's part of the sci-fi. Like, it's just loosey-goosey. There's just enough we don't know about. We don't know anything about this universe other than Westworld exists, and people still make money, and $40,000 is a lot, but something a white-collar person could earn enough to go.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like I'm becoming aware of
that. But I mean, so I guess that's why I always preface everything I'm saying with if you take this at face value, because...
Right.
We don't have any information that says, hey, they can live to 130. That's pure speculation. I'm taking it at face value until I get to the information.
If you had Occam's razor, it's not Mars. It's probably the American Southwest.
Right.
If you use Occam's razor, Anthony Hopkins, not 130. He's probably in his early 80s. Like, yes, you're right. Until proven otherwise, it's probably safer to assume reasonable current day limitations until
there's some evidence.
I mean, obviously, you can't say, well, what about their androids? Well, that's something they're showing us, and they're showing the technology,
right,
and they're showing how they advanced.
And it's a fictional universe, and once they establish those rules, I will believe them.
Yeah.
I will go with them, but I want to see those rules first.
Right.
So I don't know. It seems to me like they're trying to connect dots between the event that happened, failure, and Arnold.
This is a conversation we had before we turned the cameras and the sound recordings on. Let's talk about the nature of Anthony Hopkins' early work with Westworld, because you and I guess, got very different ideas about it. I'm starting to think that, like, old Bill, the Wild West drinker, bartender, whatever, that zipped himself in a body bag, when he says early history of Westworld, he's talking about that three-year period where they were just perfecting the hosts and there were no guests and no board members. It was just him and his technicians and his partner, and they were just pure act of creation. Mm-hmm. Because I say that because by the end of the episode, or by the end of that montage, we see the blonde woman who we later find is wearing the snake face tattoo, yeah, and shooting up people. She was a contemporary of that period of time. So I feel like they came all the way from old Bill with the whirring and clicking and shake, you know, you could tell them just by shaking her hand, to fairly modern Westworld hardware in the end of those 3-year period.
But don't we also know that Dolores was made before him? Like, she was the original, or is that
possibly
not?
But she's also been upgraded.
It's likely, but she's been upgraded, so it doesn't necessarily say that they had to act the same as they do now.
Oh, and I do definitely think they're more realistic now than they were 30 years ago, but I do think that there was, like, a minimum threshold of their realism that was achieved fairly early before the park even opened.
They said in 1 year they passed the Turing test.
Sure.
Which, and old Bill doesn't pass the fucking Turing test for me with just the way he moves. I mean,
oh, yeah.
So is he from before that era?
I think
so. Is he from within the first 3 months of their project?
Right. And that means, so Dolores, when they say she's been upgraded, they're like talking ship of Theseus or whatever, because they showed the old technology and it wasn't this milky white bullshit. It was like analog stuff getting bolted together.
Right. Artificial skin being pulled over a frame.
Right. And now they're building these robots synthetically, strand at a time, and, like, you know, they're truly being crafted. So in what sense is Dolores the oldest robot in the park? And also, they did say the oldest still active. And also, it seems like a lot of people have a lot of bad information about how the park started. It could be, you could find out that maybe she's not the original. That could be a twist later on. Who knows? I think that in my conception of this timeline is that 3 years they went from old Bill type robots to Dolores class robots.
Jesus, that's fast.
Although
that's insane.
Dolores
fast.
Herself was in the first class. And she's just been upgraded to components to bring her in line with the current stuff.
Right.
Which, what does that even mean? Like, what part? She's no longer any of part. Is it her consciousness? Her programming is the only thing that's original?
Seems like it, yeah.
Anyway. Ivan from New York says, you guys touched upon transfer of consciousness and the continuity of consciousness as a major hurdle in achieving the potentially life-extending goal. I used to be a firm believer in the possibility of this process, thinking that any transfer of consciousness would basically kill the original person and create a brand new clone. I believed this until I went to a talk on the subject during the World Science Festival in New York 1 year. One of the panelists was speaking about the subject, and she said, forget about full transfer for a second. What if you could add a small chip that would enhance your memory? You'd still be you, right? What if you could then add a chip to enhance your visual processing? You'd still be you. Now, what if you could keep adding small chips like that one at a time? Mm-hmm. Eventually, you would have to completely replace your biological brain with an artificial one, and you'd never stop being you during that process, at which point you could keep your consciousness there, or you could keep transferring it to compatible new brains. With me so far?
Yeah, no, it's the same as the car analogy.
As the Dolores analogy.
Right.
This not only opens up the possibility of such transfer to achieve dramatically longer life, but also opens up questions within Westworld. What if you need to transition slowly like that? Is this the next level the man in black is looking for? Maybe the next level is the level in which you slowly become a machine and, in a sense, you never leave. Could any of the hosts be failed transfers? It's too early to ask questions like these with any serious footing, but I guess we can always speculate.
Thank you for adding that last part, because, yeah, there's not even a hint that people are becoming hosts. There's no hint of that. I mean, we've seen them actually fabricating hosts. Like,
right.
They wouldn't need to do that if it were just incremental upgrades done to human beings.
I think it's not right to say there's no hint, because there is that scary language in the terms of service for the park that says they own all your skin cells and your sperm cells and your shit and your piss and your vinegar. Why put that in there if they're not doing something weird with the guest DNA?
Right. But I don't think the guest... I don't think this is Hotel California. I don't think that's literally what's happening here.
It's funny because I actually cut for time a couple emails that speculated that indeed, like, that if you die in the park, you don't really die, you just become a host.
Okay.
Again, that's just an idea. That's not a theory. There's no support for that. Hey, it would be cool if you get a buffalo stampeded and now you wake up and...
Right.
And then you're a host.
And honestly, that feels like a much more natural trajectory toward some kind of, human in a robot body scenario.
Well, so there's the other things, because I didn't read this because I thought it was part of the uninteresting boilerplate, but a couple people took me to task and said, why didn't you read this part? There's also a part in the liability and indemnification that says that any crime that a human would perpetrate upon another human would have to be investigated by the Delos staff, who would then engage the proper authorities as necessary.
Okay.
Which kind of means that they could easily cover up.
But how do you tell the difference?
What do you mean?
Like, if I'm gonna drop somebody off a cliff...
Yeah.
How do I tell the difference between a host and a human? A host and a guest?
I do think that if a host threw a guest off a cliff, they would know it. There would be the host's own record. There'd be telemetry involved.
If a guest was throwing a guest off a cliff... Like, if I grab somebody, I decide, I walk into the park, and I'm like, I'm going to throw somebody off a cliff today.
Okay.
That sounds like a fun thing to do. And I grab someone off the street, and I go for it.
He just drag. Yeah.
How do I know
that's a safe word? And, like, whether people are being instanced or not. I mean, you're right, because the person could say, I'm a guest.
Right.
And you're a host.
Yeah, you're a host, and you could plausibly deny it. I had no fucking idea.
I hope
idea.
They address that, how humans can tell. Because
you can't put stipulations on someone when they literally can't tell the difference.
Well, and also, if this ammunition is lethal at close range, it seems like a guest could just put their, barrel in their head, against someone's eyeball and blow their eye out.
Right, and who's to say
I guess
the
host reflex, like you, but again, you could easily have, like, a husband and wife out in a desert, and one of them just decides to throw another off a cliff.
Right.
And I guess that's something that you would agree to, is like, that's a possibility. Don't stand too close to the cliff by someone you can't fully trust in the terms of service.
Well, in that case, they would obviously know that person was a guest.
But yeah, I get your point.
Husband,
I hope they do address, because they kind of did when Logan says, well, there's only one way to find out, and aims his gun at somebody.
Like, that could have been a guest.
And then they'd just be like, hey, asshole, you just shot me. And it wouldn't kill them.
But what if he had decided to do the knife stab thing to a guest to see?
Yeah, I guess the host would stop him. But how would they know?
How would they know before it's too late?
This is treading dangerously close to it's a sci-fi fiction concept, and you just need to accept that they thought of that. I hope they address it.
I hope they show, like,
just like there's some
is...
people that hope they give a 15-minute PowerPoint presentation on simmunitions. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying we'll get it, but yeah, I kind of hope so.
Even if it were like, we gather all the people into a single room and we show them to each other and say, don't kill any of these people.
Yeah,
don't harm any of these people.
This is a real face.
And now it's on you. Now you have responsibility and liability for it.
Yeah,
so.
You'll be open to criminal proceedings. Guy from Montana says, I know I love a show and I'm constantly checking to see how much time is left in the episode. I do the same with Game of Thrones. Stop doing that, man.
Oh, yeah, I never do.
I try to avoid... because I find that influences my perception of the episode. If I know I'm like, if I'm really absorbed in an episode and I see it, like, kind of shocks me that when the black screen comes up, that's when I gauge a really great episode.
Yeah, for me, it's exactly opposite of what he's saying. If I'm checking the clock, I'm bored.
Yeah, but I think also it's like, I can see people doing that because it's kind of like being anxious about how much you've got left to enjoy.
Right.
But I also feel like that's a constant reminder of the artificiality of what you're watching.
Sure.
But to each their own, Guy, if that is your real name. Very generic host-like name. Mm-hmm. One element I'm having a hard time with is the idea of having a place to have placed breached units in cold storage. Why is this necessary? If these units are like any other computing device, they consist of hardware and software. The show refers to past configurations and wiping of the unit's memory, so this necessarily indicates some form of hard drive storage. If this is the case, why would the whole unit need to be discarded or decommissioned in the event of a malfunction? I feel like this is throwing the baby out the bathwater. Could not a unit's hard drive be completely scrubbed or in some extreme cases be replaced with a brand new unit? The operating system is loaded and the kernel tweak for the specific unit and back in service you go. No need to shelve the hardware because of a software problem, unless this technology has somehow merged the software with the hardware and they are too inextricably linked. If that's the only real explanation, but the show has yet to say this is the case. I feel like you answered your own question, man, that they don't have, that there is some kind of emergent properties to the consciousness of these robots that they themselves are afraid of. And any robot that breaches their reality, which is something they're programmed not to do, can no longer be trusted. Because if they did it once, even if you wipe it and it's and they somehow have access to their previous configurations, wirelessly or otherwise, I just feel like it's just an absolute safeguard. It's cheaper to 3D print another host than it is to risk them running amok.
After I said swap a chip earlier, I immediately realized, you know, I have no idea how these things are constructed in any manner. I mean, so it is possible that their hardware and software are physically linked in the way that our brains are both hardware and software.
And that's, I want to understand how much of these people are meat. Like, do they have a process that turns this polymer into flesh and blood? Or is this like a Terminator endoskeleton type of thing?
That's a good question.
Because that may, if she had like, that looked like about an inch of meat on her. Like when they're cutting into her. Like a real abdominal wall.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet I've seen their musculature in that milky white shit. So that implies there needs to be a thin layer of skin over them, maybe.
Well, I mean, what if I want to rip the guts out of one of these things? Can I do it?
I know. You should be able to, right?
If you want to provide a realistic experience, sure.
Like, if you dig past the first half inch, do you get the milky white goodness?
Right.
The nougat inside? Like, I don't know. Yeah. I feel like they need to answer that question, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're playing with the milk. And also, for the record, yes, I do realize that this is an homage to the aliens or the androids and alien.
Right.
Gotten about 15 of those emails too.
Yes.
If you've seen the aliens and the androids in the alien franchise, they're all constructed out of this milky white goo stuff as well. Mm-hmm. But they also have like weird internal organs and shit, which I guess these guys do too.
These are not, I guess, the big questions that I'm looking for answers for necessarily. It would be nice if they answered them,
right?
But honestly,
do
you really care? Do you really care how your sci-fi universe exactly operates?
I don't know.
Do I need to know how the lithium crystals are broken down for energy in the Enterprise's engines?
As a man who owned the technical manual as a teenager and has the answer memorized by rote, yes, I do. Secondly, when the first episode shows them mounting a white horse heart in a horse chassis, yes, I want to know how that eventually pumps red blood and what does that blood do and et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
Second question, which I'm not sure matters in the grand scheme, but it keeps nagging me. Why have we not seen Dolores' mother? I've gotten a lot of people emailing me about Dolores' mother, so I want to talk about this as a theme, too. The omission of actually seeing her face in the first episode feels almost purposeful.
Mm-hmm.
The first we know of her is the reveal that she's been shot by the necrophiliac milk bandits. We see her on her back, but we never see her face. Why? Would it not serve a standard narrative purpose to show her, thus making Dolores' family life feel that much more real? In subsequent scenes of Dolores at home, we see her wake up, then cut to her outside walking by her father. Why not have her come out from her room to her mother cooking breakfast or something? From there, we can hear Dolores call out for her a couple times. Once for sure when Abernathy is having his existential crisis. The mother never appears, though. Why is that? From a tropey storytelling standpoint, having Dolores' mother on the scene freaking out alongside her would be a natural world-building and storytelling element. But she never appears. I have a suspicion the reveal of who's Dolores' mother will have a significant impact on some mystery of the overarching story. Perhaps she will be someone we already know of in real life, confirming the idea that these hosts are in fact clones to a degree, or maybe someone connected to Men in Black. Man in Black. As a counterpoint guy, I've watched the same amount of episodes as you, and I've never once had this question. I hear them referring to a mother. I see a dead mother. The mother seems to serve the narrative point of dying. Mm-hmm. To me, that's nice and tidy, and I'm not seeing anything sinister or significant in the fact that she's not there. So I don't think, like, I feel like you can't draw a universal kind of story mythos from the fact that there's been an inconsistency. Have you noticed, you know? Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, are you curious about her mother?
I suppose I'm curious about it, but I guess I'm with you. I don't know that them not showing her has a purpose beyond just tightening up those scenes.
Focusing the attention on her and her relationship with her father and the strangeness of her father being replaced.
Right.
Like, that's significant, and they're addressing that. The mother just seems like a background detail.
Yeah.
I don't know. It'd be like worrying about what brand of condensed milk she's dropping, you know? I guess that's how I see it, but I could be wrong, but I just don't. And again, if it is significant, leaping that to the fact that, oh, it's going to be someone we know of real life, or it's the connection to the Man in Black, or maybe it's going to be Teresa from accounting, like that.
Yep.
That's like, how do you get there from here? I don't know.
Anthony Hopkins in a wig.
It's Anthony Hopkins in a wig. That's the best theory I've heard all week. Damon says, the Man in Black is Arnold. About 30 years ago, he had a falling out with Delos and his partner Ford, and he was let go, but given all access to the park, likened to a founder.
Wait, he wasn't let go. He was killed.
Right.
He's
well,
dead.
He's going with the this is all a lie bullshit kind of thing.
Okay, sure.
Likened to a founder who becomes CEO and is voted out, given stocks in the company. In part to offset the enormous expenditures in starting the whole thing up. Hence, he was not involved in a further evolution of Westworld, so he doesn't know any of its deeper games after his departure. To the host, it's as if he died. So he's going with a Ben Kenobi sense of the word.
Okay.
Now, the other thing is, and I don't know if this, I might have copy and pasted this in error, but I got this image now, so I'm going to talk about it. I mentioned up front that the ARG, if you go to visitwestworld.com, there's a little box where you can ask questions, and you're talking to an AI, and you can ask them, you know, questions like, you know, what is Westworld, or who are the people I'm going to visit? But if you ask them questions like, who are you, and you're insistent about it, or if you repeat to, if you type in these violent...
Delights have violent ends,
he freaks the fuck out, and he... It says system error, 404 not found. It gives a bunch of error debugging code, and it's a bunch of gibberish. There's what looks like a URL string that has a whole bunch of like a sequence of 36 characters, and it says equals FLY, fly. But then it says, you're in a prison of your own sins at the end of the statement. Hell is empty. The devils are here. Arnold will come. What the fuck?
If Arnold
is dead, who is programming these bots with the knowledge of him? Or are these bots accessing the code that he wrote 30 years ago with his bicameral mind business?
Right. I mean, Arnold could be their god.
Ooh.
I mean, Arnold could be this bicameral authority voice that they're hearing.
Okay.
Because that's one of the things of the bicameral, you know, mind theory is that when consciousness emerged, a lot of people attributed it to God. That's where we came up with the idea of God.
Yeah.
Because we heard voices we couldn't explain.
That's nice and tidy from a secular point of view, sure.
Right. So, like, if you extend that to Arnold being the guy who was trying to originally program them with consciousness, he could be perceived as their God, certainly. All right. And, I mean, I think that's going to come into play here, like, with what we've been talking about with Ford trying to construct a scenario in which maybe the religion is reintroduced into this world, right?
Right.
Like, maybe that's part of him actively trying to push this along.
Right.
That now they have both this voice and they can attribute it to some concept called God, some concept of Arnold.
Uh-huh.
Which is a rather pedestrian name for a god, but
sure,
we'll go with it.
I don't know. Is it any weirder than Ra or Yahweh or... Arnold.
Arnold. I suppose
say it
is only
times.
Because it's in a contemporary
Arnold.
Language.
I put a diacritic mark over to A and put a dash between Arnold. Arnold.
Arnold.
Arnold of old. Arnold of hosts of armies. Yeah, that's it's kind of. See, I've already can talk myself in. Arnold sounds like a weird alien name now. Any other thoughts? That's pretty tasty, yep. though. And dovetails into Ford introducing religion.
Right.
And as a way to worship the previous co-founder. That's right. Interesting. Robin from Oxford says, there's a nugget in one of the Pat questions that you can ask Aiden. That's the name of the AI that I've been talking about in the visitwestworld.com. You can ask it, who will I meet? And you get the answer. Westworld has an endless cast of characters all just waiting to meet you. There's a 10-to-1 host-to-guest ratio to ensure your every desire is fulfilled. She continues, now other than revealing... Or maybe it's a man, Robin. That could be neutral. Now, other than revealing the ratios are expressed with hyphens instead of colons in the future, which is crazy. This suggests to me, because it says 10-1, not 10:1. Mm-hmm. This suggests to me that multiple guests and or groups of guests would be sharing park space at any one time and that things are not instanced. We've seen crowds of dozens and dozens of hosts in Sweetwater. If the ratio is just 10-1, there would have to be many more guests to balance this math. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm putting the kibosh on the VR instance stuff.
Me too.
I don't think it's possible.
Me too. Next email, Natalie S. When listening to your last podcast, I was really intrigued by your theory or the theory introduced by you and your PlayStation party friend about how Dr. Ford plans on introducing religion to the robots and Westworld. This theory made me think that Jim and your discussion of the True Detective podcast season 2 on the Western Book of the Dead, the actual book written in the 70s, not the episode itself. Do you remember that? Because I didn't.
Vaguely. I remember that we had it. I don't remember what it was about.
Right. And that podcast, Jim outlines the details of the book and as they play out as such. And I'm about to totally plagiarize Jim.
Please.
Plagiarize the book.
Refresh my memory.
Because the book is a pamphlet. It was like a 17-page thing you can get the PDF of.
Right.
The book itself is very rare. Yes, yeah. I did too.
And I remember not a damn bit of it.
Yep. The book outlines the timelines of life from the beginning of the universe to the formation of organic mass and a consciousness, to the development of society and love, to the tale that these people tell of God, purpose, and love, which creates God and religion. Then there's the development of science and reason, which leads to the loss of God and the belief that there is no point, that all humans are meaningless mass, that there is no meaning or reason to existence, and that we can do whatever we want, which leads to society collapsing and the downfall of civilization due to a lack of morals and purpose. Jim also explains that in the book, God is love, happiness, and he leads people to being happy with their existence. That by creating God, you create a larger purpose for people, and people need to search for these existential questions. I think these ideas are applicable to the ideas being put forth in Westworld and may prove and explain the theory of Dr. Ford wanting to bring religion to this world in more ways than one. I think Dr. Ford wants to bring these robots into actual existence and give them a real quote-unquote life. It's strongly implied that Ford is responsible for the robots' newfound awareness or access to their past memories. Dr. Ford not only wants these robots to become sentient, he wants to go one step forward. He wants them to be as real as possible. What better way to make these robots real than to give them one of the most universal experiences that people go through, that of existential questions regarding God and existence and where one goes after they die? Furthermore, even though we don't know much about the world outside of Westworld, Dr. Ford has explained that the world is done evolving as all illnesses have been cured and technology is at its peak. Thus, introducing religion into Westworld will begin the next phase of evolution as outlined in the Western Book of the Dead. The world outside the park also seems to be the last phase outlined in the book. Obviously, reason and science are prevailing powers in the world. Religion does not seem to be that big of a deal in the world anymore. In the way that people act, if the way that people act in a park is any indication, moral righteousness is not a dominant trait in people. I don't know. I mean, some of the it's turned out that some of the most righteous seeming people in the real world are also the biggest hypocrites. Like the ones campaigning against for family values are the ones that are, you know, having sex with their male staffers in the bathrooms. Like
sure, but like I think the Western Book of the Dead is a fairly short-sighted nihilistic take on the whole human experience.
Okay.
I think so. I don't believe that just because I guess I don't buy that everything is meaningless if right. you don't have a God.
Right.
If there isn't some higher power than humanity, and even if ultimately it is in fact meaningless to the universe, there's still enjoyment to be had in the moment. There are many other things, but I think it's interesting from this bicameral standpoint where you say, okay, people started thinking that there was a God because they were hearing these voices and they attributed it to this concept of God.
Yeah.
Ford might be trying to introduce that to them. And the bicameral mind is essentially the evolution of that is a way for people to understand themselves, right?
Right.
And a way for consciousness to evolve. And so, and I don't mean like physically evolve. I mean evolve in its form, mm-hmm. Just change and, mm-hmm. and progress. But this is, so, and I also don't necessarily think that attributing these voices to a god is a particularly good way to go about developing consciousness, because, you know, it causes a lot of problems in my mind. But I think it might be necessary to form, in these kind of primordial consciousnesses, to form some concept of what these voices are so that you can have this inner monologue and therefore continue to evolve your consciousness.
Right. You have to, like, when you have emergence consciousness, you have to label that phenomenon within your own consciousness something.
In order to start to understand
it.
Like
when the first man saw the sun, it's a god. Why wouldn't it be? It's up in the heavens. It sustains life, blah, blah, blah.
And if right now it's just hallucinations and all they're doing is they're just hearing voices, disembodied voices.
Yeah, you have to context that somehow.
Right. You would want to give them some context so that they can start to evolve into whatever they're going to evolve into. And it's, I don't know. I think it's a way that he's trying to jumpstart it. I agree.
We got off a little bit of the weeds here from the Natalie's point. She asserts that, she, in her opinion, William's the only decent human we've met, which I kind of want to quibble because, you know, when I play Call of Duty and I'm murdering a bunch of people, I'm not really murdering a bunch of people. So if, I mean, yes, I'm disturbed by what they're getting up to, and I don't, I wouldn't play a rape simulator video game, even if one such a thing exists. Does such a thing exist?
But you do play murder simulators.
I do
so,
play murder
simulators.
Yeah, that's an arbitrary moral ethical decision for me to make.
Yeah, no, I read an article earlier today about specifically about like the sexual. The mixing of sex and violence in Westworld, and whether or not if the Westworld existed in the real world, that would be an okay thing, that it would cause like the decline of morality and humanity, and we have those already. It's just not quite as vivid.
Also, we should probably draw a distinction. I don't play murder simulators. I play simulations where I'm the good guy and I'm murdering, and or I'm the anti-hero and I'm murdering other equally bad people. Like, I know there's some things like Postal and where you literally are just playing a maniacal person. I don't play those, but also I wouldn't say that someone that did is a maniac.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, that's why I don't think necessarily those things lead to...
Like, I would play a sex simulator. I would not play a rape simulator. There's a diff, like, you know, murder versus killing is a different thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, if you want to assert that, that's fine. And maybe Dr. Ford sees that too, because her larger point that Dr. Ford sees how actual society is on the brink of collapse, or in any case, sees how society has nowhere else to go. Returning to her point, ultimately, I think Dr. Ford wants to eventually upload his consciousness into a robot and live in Westworld. The catch is he does not want to live in a Westworld controlled by selfish humans with unaware robots who follow the same storylines every day. By bringing religion into Westworld, a revolution will occur, and the robots will not only be able to make their own choices, but they will be completely real. The Western Book of the Dead outlines how God is love, and love leads to happiness and existence. Dr. Ford wants that for himself and for his robots. He wants to reset humanity succeeding. And every writer's visionary person with a God complex's ultimate dream, creating a thriving, sustaining new world. That, I feel like, even if I don't agree with her thesis leading up to this, I think that's kind of compelling. That if he wants to upload his consciousness or he wants to transcend death, he doesn't want to do so in a world that sees artificial beings as pleasure things.
Okay. I wouldn't want to either.
Right. So, like, you have to lead a robot civil rights movement before you upload your consciousness into a robot, yeah? Right.
Otherwise, you're uploading your consciousness into a slave?
Yeah. Like, how would people like see that? Thing. Like, it's like, well, you know, I think you think people would be discomforted with the notion that, like, oh, well, human intelligence is in this thing?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell have we been doing with these human intelligences this whole time?
We are, I think, ascribing a lot of motivation to Dr. Ford.
That we don't know of.
I wish we had more of his backstory, because that would inform his actions in the present a lot more.
Yeah.
Maybe we'd understand him better. So I hope that we get more young Anthony Hopkins, we get a little more CG, and it starts to become clear through his past why he's acting the way he is.
Well, and if you subscribe to that robot as being Anthony Hopkins as a very young boy, then maybe we've gotten more of his backstory than we appreciate.
Maybe.
And that we'll realize that in the fullness of time. A guy named TG, which I because I've gotten a couple emails from people making claims of being connected at some level or another with this, you know, production, which is kind of a unique phenomenon. I've not normally been approached by people affiliated with the show, but this guy claims to supply some of the props to the show, and he says that the gun provided to Westworld for Ed Harris is a Lamat revolver, which is interesting. It's an 8-shot revolver, and I don't think it has a removable cylinder like I was speculating. That might have been like a speed loader, because you can. There's devices that they make that allow you to very rapidly reload a revolver. Like, people that practice with them can get it down into seconds,
yeah,
which would explain the shot discrepancy. Mm-hmm. But the cool thing about the Lamat revolver is that it has a single-shot shotgun underslung underneath the barrel.
Yeah, we saw him use it a couple times. He blasts the bartender with it.
Right. So you've got 8 shots plus that, and then you get a speed loader. It's a unique gun and a pretty cool gun.
Yeah.
So I just want to pass that detail along, and there you go. Lucas from Milwaukee said, big fan of AI-related shows and AI-related podcasts. I noticed during your first two episodes you mentioned being able to download your consciousness into the computer, but with the caveat that it's many, many years away. However, we're actually systematically mapping the brain synapses by synapses. I attached a YouTube link of an entertaining interview with Michio Kaku from The Daily Show. Start at 4:15 for the mapping your brain to the CD-ROM conversation.
Michio Kaku, if I'm not wrong, is a cosmologist?
Oh, I think I know who you're talking about. I don't think that's the same guy, though.
I know who Michio Kaku is. I know his face.
Oh, shit. I've seen him. Yes, it is. Yeah. It's the same guy.
I don't want to say he doesn't know what he's talking about, but he's not in the field.
You're right.
That's like Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about
material sciences.
Right.
He probably knows more than a guy you just pull out a sidewalk, but if he asserts something about high carbon steel,
yeah,
take it with a grain of salt.
You might go ask someone who was working in the field before you build something out of it.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, I feel like, okay, so I'll continue this email before we get a bad habit of discussing half-formed thoughts here. Sure. I thought that you would be interested to know that just recently a big tech companies have assembled a consortium to debate what ethics of AI should be. This includes companies like IBM, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and Facebook. Yeah, all of them paragons of ethics and virtue.
Well, but all of the
you
leaders.
You want to bring them to the table. The UN is not just the Western world. It's also North Korea.
They're the leaders in AI right now. So,
All these companies use AI in some form, and they want to get a general consensus on to some interesting questions. For example, in a self-driving car, it's on a bridge, there are 5 people in its way, and there are only 2 physical options due to the speed of the car. Hit the 5 people or drive off the bridge. Either choice will endanger one of the 2 groups, so what should it decide? Interesting question.
I think the more interesting question is there are 5 people in the car and 5 people on the bridge.
I think that's the implication. There's like, you got 2, like 5 people in the car, 5. I think that's the implication.
Okay.
Or there's at least one person. Mm-hmm. Does it maximize the value of human life? Does it side with the owner of the vehicle?
We just need to put turbo boosters on every car and it can jump over them like Kit.
Sure. They need to have the ability to stop time and wait for the authorities to come. Interesting questions that AI will need to be answered quickly if humans would still like the control of the answers. I agree, and I'm glad that's something that we were asking about. Although I do feel like Westworld and stuff like that are important because it shouldn't be just these companies debating this. Like, I feel like this should be a robust debate. Like, we didn't let reproductive rights be decided by a consortium of pharmaceutical companies. We didn't let civil rights be debated by a consortium of, I don't know what you did, the equivalent of that. But, you know, everyone needs to have a say in this stuff, right?
Sure, yeah.
To the extent that people are religious, like religious people should have a say in some of these ethical questions as well. It's like, I'm glad that companies themselves are asking them, but I think it's appropriate for like governmental and civilian agencies and we the people to weigh in as well.
Right. I especially don't want just for-profit businesses in on this because they may come to conclusions that someone who's not worried about the bottom line of these companies may not come to.
Right. Kate D from New York City, says on I started this because that's an interesting idea, this whole concept about what do you do with this bridge situation. and I'm starting to like problem solve it.
I feel like we need a podcast just for that.
Yeah.
Just call it The Bridge.
Yeah. But this thing's like, what? And I'm like, no, you know what? Whatever you've come up with in a distracted 2.5 minutes is not going to be.
So you look up, you face recognize every single person in the scenario, you see who's the worst, and you just have a plow into them or drive them off the bridge.
Are there how many felons, convicted felons? Right. And like, were those felons featured on season one of Serial or Making a Murderer? And
are they violent criminals? Are they?
I was going more like, why would a self-driving car drive faster than it can see probabilities of things happening? Like if it couldn't,
oh,
if
it
it's
should
on a
prepare like
on
I
a blind
people.
Like on a blind curve, it should slow down so it's reasonably certain that it could hit the brakes and stop within the distance of anything that would be revealed. Like people don't do that, but fucking mm-hmm. self-driving cars should.
Well, but then I mean, you couldn't have them drive down the streets of like New York City, for instance.
Why?
At more than 10 miles per hour, because someone could randomly, a homeless man could jump in front, somebody could be jaywalking unexpectedly.
Maybe it's not a bad idea, because like, you know, 10 mile an hour car streets is New York City during like rush hour times probably seem like a good deal.
Maybe
the traffic is proceeding at a stately pace, but it is proceeding.
I don't know about that.
In anyway, like, again, the most obvious answer I can come up with is not interesting to anybody, so let's move on.
I say it should hit them and then drive off the bridge. just pull
no
the ripcord.
No half measures.
No.
This is, yeah, just go for maximum devastation if there's no choice. Kate D. from New York City said, in last week's episode, you'd brought up the episode title Chestnut as it pertained to the color of horses, but I have one better for you. A chestnut is also a term for the callosity on the leg of horses that is a vestigial toe, an evolutionary remnant from when equines had three toes. So, like that, I guess that you know, they're little, kind of like, you know, some dogs have that dew claw that doesn't do anything. Like what the analogous feature on a horse is called a chestnut. I think this episode title may describe the way in which the hosts are evolving past understandings of man, as well as a way for the hosts are retaining parts of their past within themselves. Yet another example of how Dr. Ford is playing the role of creator may be further to be discussed if religion is introduced, which could create an interesting dichotomy of religion versus evolution. Oh, that's kind of cool, too. I like that. I didn't know that about horses. That's pretty cool. It's a vestigial feature. It's tying in evolutionary mistakes and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else to...
Nope.
Moving on. AJV. In the first episode, during the second time Dolores wakes up, there's a group of Japanese tourists. This is the email I was trying to find. A husband and wife in purple and a group of three guys, one of whom said the last time he was here, Teddy showed them around. All of these guests were on the same scene, which makes me think the guests are not partitioned into separate experiences, which I think you call instancing. Yes.
Yeah.
That's definitive proof. So no more VR instancing.
Right.
Unless it's... shown to be otherwise, in which case we'll say it's a bunch of inconsistent bullshit and we just need to accept it.
Okay.
All right. Mallory W., one thing I was immediately intrigued by one of your last shows was the description of the Delos corporate map of the Mesa Hub. I took a look at one of the illustrations, and after watching episode 2, I started to think about this layout once more. I started to think about this layout more once the man in black was describing his search for the maze and his desire to find a deeper level of Westworld. For one, could he be trying to enter the old cold storage level of the facility where the faulty livestock are stored, since that is literally the deepest level?
Hmm.
Additionally, the map, that would be kind of interesting. You lead a robot revolt of a bunch of unstable, breached robots. Additionally, the map of Mesa Hub bears a striking resemblance to the depictions of the circles of hell from Dante's Inferno. It seems like there could be a sort of connection there, especially because Westworld itself appears as if it was partially created to be an outlet for human beings' most immoral and sinful desires. I'm not sure if there's anything there or not, but take a look for yourself. The hierarchy and stratification in the Mesa facilities does really bear a lot in common with the circles of hell. I mean,
right. You
got a black steeple and a cross. You got people talking about hells being empty because the devils are here. Like, it's totally grist for the mill to mm-hmm. talk about this in terms of seven circles of hell, yeah?
Yeah.
And I would say that it's probably intentional design choices at this mm-hmm. point. Joe from Philly, I'm frustrated with myself when I watch this show and all the prestige dramas because I'm always waiting for the twist. Is Bernard a host? Is Westworld on Mars? Is Arnold still alive? Is the man in black Arnold? Is the man in black a host? Ah! I've decided to watch and enjoy and not get too tinfoily and enjoy the drama and the mysteries and the questions and answers to be had, and that is great. To me, this is different than a twist. A twist being defined by me as thinking things are one way and the creators say, nope, it's really this way, i.e. the theory that Bernard is not human like you thought all this time, but a host. What they did in episode one was fun because they played with their expectations with Teddy and the man in black and who was the host in that scenario, but did so in the course of a single episode. That's fine, and in fact, I like it. I don't want a game like Mr. Robot Season 2 played because it doesn't add anything to the actual story and just gets some way, in some ways takes focus from the narrative just to say that you got to say gotcha to the audience. What do you guys think? Would you enjoy some wow type of twist, or in the Reddit culture, can that never truly exist because someone has already guessed it? I have to say that I'm leaning more towards Joe from Philly, but I also run a podcast where at least half the audience derives enjoyment from figuring out the mysteries and claiming internet points on who's right and who's wrong. So I'm kind of caught.
Yeah. This is why, I mean, we had this question in our Q&A, like, what show would you like to have not covered?
Right.
And my answer was all of them, so I can enjoy the shows again.
Yes.
I mean, I still enjoy the shows, but like...
not on the level we used to.
Right. It's not just purely me watching it anymore. It's now everyone who listens to my podcast.
And that's going through my head. It's not my point of view and my theories that I like. I have to share them all, and they all have to occupy equal space in my head.
Right. And also, the theories that we're bringing are laden with the commentary of everyone on, like you said, Reddit. So, like, yeah, they're not as big a surprise anymore because someone probably has figured them out. And also, I don't feel like I can strongly defend or debunk a theory because it's not my theory. And I'm not having a conversation about it. The conversation has already been had. What I'm doing is reiterating the thoughts of 100,000 people
that I didn't even necessarily agree with.
Right.
But I have to do that to be fair and balanced and, you know, not to be overly I mean, I definitely there's editorial voice here. Like, I'm choosing not to read, you know, slight variations on the, you know, Man in Black is the founder, the Man in Black is William, or like, there's a lot of people that have unique twists on that, but like, goddamn, literally I'd have what, 20, 30 emails that I'd read just on minor variations of the Man in Black theory this week. I can't.
Right.
I can't. Especially when I say I'm not that super interested and invested in that theory. Mm-hmm. So there is an editorial voice, but I do try, like, I don't suppress the idea that that theory is out there, or the alternate timeline theory.
This is the tricameral mind. It's the life of a podcaster, the next step in human consciousness.
Right. It's the symbol for infinity cameral mind, because it's however many people are on Reddit and typing stuff into my inbox. That's what I got to consider.
Yep.
And I'm not complaining. I'm just saying the difficulty of, like, there are some shows where I think that you are encouraged to do this deep diving. There's shows that encourage it that don't reward it. And there's the rare show that both encourages it and rewards it.
Right.
And it's not my place to say which is the right way to enjoy the show. Because ultimately, I do the show for everybody. Like, or that's the goal, right? I don't want any fan of Westworld to listen to this and be like, oh, these guys, you know, not representing me and my viewpoints. So,
sure.
Colin has a quick thought after listening to our last podcast that he wants our opinion on. We have Dolores having flashbacks of the town shot up with the dead people all over the ground. We've seen Maeve's flashbacks of her and her daughter running from a Native American attack. I've heard your theories on what management's true goal is, possibly perfecting hosts to become some sort of immortal bodies for human souls. What if some of the current hosts were previous guests that perished in Westworld? Ah, yes, this email did make it through. What if the flashbacks are the human memories before they died in the park? Is it possible that, for example, Maeve was a real human visitor at one point, died in Westworld, had a host created for her image, and had her soul uploaded into the shell, and these flashbacks are actually her human memories surfacing? It's possible.
Yeah.
What does that mean, that they're covering up all these murders, and not only covering up, but... I mean, I feel like that's just the opposite of covering it up. Because what happens if you're Maeve's daughter... you know, other daughter that she didn't bring to Westworld on this adventure, and you come back and like, oh my god, my mom's the head prostitute in the saloon. I'm suing you bastards. Like, that's the opposite of covering up a murder.
And then they say, we own her cells, we own her you skin, agreed her to hair, her chins.
You agree, she agreed to allow us to investigate this murder, and we found out that it was, you know, just not a murder.
Right. And now we're using her skin in the park.
It could be happening, but I got
But it muddies the waters narratively for me, because the theme of this show is the emergence of consciousness, right?
Yes. And what does that it mean to be human?
That is watered down by the idea that an already conscious being would just be put into the park. That's not the emergence of consciousness. That's the transfer of consciousness. And I think it's fundamentally different.
No, I do think that they are – that it's on the table that that question is being asked as well, with Anthony Hopkins being the
old-ass
guy
trying to avoid death. Okay, but I think they need to get past the first part of this, which is the emergence of consciousness within this AI.
Okay.
That's just me. If I were writing the show, I would not want to muddy the waters too much.
I think they can tackle both questions, but I do think that it's muddying the water because it's the same type of question they're already asking, perhaps with Anthony Hopkins, that they're now doing with, like, and what if everybody else is doing this too?
Right.
Like, that's,
and it's
I guess,
the same reason I don't like, and what if Anthony Hopkins is a host? I'm like, that's not what the show needs to be about. If they want to ask these bigger questions.
Well, I don't want to put the show in a box.
But that's like a sci-fi narrative twist, not an interesting thematic notion, right?
Yeah, I mean, because I'm on the one that I personally don't like the idea that Harrison Ford is a replicant in Blade Runner. Like, I disagree with Ridley fucking Scott. Like, I don't think that that's in the work, and I don't think it was intended. But the show's creator says I'm wrong. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely am sympathetic to what you're saying. But I don't know that we can use that as a way to rule out whether something's true or not, because they could just be doing something that we don't like.
Sure. Or they could have a way to do it that like.
Yeah, that we're like, if you told us, you know, that, we might be like, well, that's dumb, but then you do it in a certain way. It's like, oh, well, that's actually awesome.
Right.
Dylan from Alabama says, I find this episode good, but I noticed that when a human is shot, they feel a sting from a bullet. It looks sort of like a paintball impact. What do you think that means for the Man in Black? Is he wearing a shield that makes the bullets ricochet off him? Does he know how to circumvent the systems? I really like how the show plays too many video game tropes like cheat codes or whatnot. The final option would be that he's just accustomed to the impact, but it looked to me like the bullets didn't faze him at all.
Yeah.
Ding, ding, ding. Winner, winner, chicken dinner, I feel like.
He just takes it.
Yeah. Because like I said, the first time you get shot by a paintball, you're like, son of a bitch, that hurt. Later that afternoon, or certainly if you keep playing the sport, like, you don't register. In fact, the biggest problem I see is fucking cheaters pretending like they didn't get shot.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so, because I always found that annoying. Like, after, like, the first couple of games, yeah, you see when someone's got paint on them, but the fourth or fifth game, I definitely saw motherfuckers getting shot and just not screaming. So, I feel like that, yeah, you get used to pain.
Yeah.
Like, diabetics, like, the fact of getting myself a shot every day horrifies me. If I got diabetes, I'm pretty sure I'd get used to doing that over death and probably wouldn't be a big deal at all.
Like martial artists, they get used to the impacts.
Yeah, I've seen the movies. They plunge their hands into big things of stone and then it wears it down to dust. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
They pick up boiling cauldrons and brand their... Yeah, they do all kinds of weird shit.
Talking about real-life martial artists, not some drunken master bullshit.
What? That was a documentary? Oh, man. You're shattering all my illusions. Also, closing, he's from Alabama, wants to know if we're going to be at the Yellowhammer party Friday. He's alluding to the Rocket City NerdCon.
Yeah.
Which
be there at least for a while.
You don't have tickets, rocketcitynerdcon.org in Huntsville, Alabama. Yeah, I would say don't plan on us to shut the place down.
Yeah.
Because we're there to work, man. Partying is not
to do and...
partying is not high on our definitely it's on our list of things to do. But yeah, I wouldn't say that we're gonna close the place down. But yeah, we'll be there. Mm-hmm. We'll be there hanging out for a bit. So if you want to guarantee seeing us there, be there earlier rather than later, I'd say. That's all the emails we got.
Okay.
If you want to send us more, westworld@baldmove.com, or on the forums, we have lively show threads each week. People are posting their own theories and whatnot at forums.baldmove.com. We'll see what happens next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Bye.